and see whether that expenditure has been done properly. these are fully fledged companies operating in the disciplines of the marketplace, operating within the disciplines of the capital markets, but not operating as pure private entities, operating within carefully defined economic parameters and targets. And there has not been a time in South Africa's history, which I think is another challenge for the department and yourselves, where we've ever undertaken investment in this manner. If you can think of the previous investment drive, where we had South African Railways and Harbours and Electricity Supply Commission, they were not state enterprises before. They were operating very much as state-supported activities off the budget. So this is a relatively new phenomenon for our economy, and it really is quite crucial. There are two aspects of the energy that I'd like to stress. The need to build new generating capacity is absolutely critical. But it's not just building it, we have to build it on time. If we don't meet our targets of 2010-2011, we will exacerbate the crisis. So it is everything that we do with Eskom, and I'll come to it in a moment, to the complexity of what's happening. We've got to keep monitoring that program, give the company all the support we can to ensure that we meet the target. Today's newspaper, and I'm very pleased this is the case, has also highlighted one of the dangers of underinvestment, and that is that for too long now, we have not invested in the distribution sector either. So we really are at a point where we've got to clarify urgently the precise responsibility in generation, transmission, and distribution. We've all seen the effects of strain on the electricity grid, and we have to correct this. I'm very pleased with the progress we're making. We have some tight corners to get through, particularly for what's called Project Alpha in electricity, because we need a big new baseload station, and that must come on stream by 2010-2011. So we're working flat out to get that going. But we also know that we have to change the composition of our primary energy source. We could not continue to replicate the amount of electricity derived from coal. And this has led to the decision, a very important decision, which we see as the only feasible decision in the coming 20 years, and that is to boost the amount of energy we get from nuclear sources so that probably half, maybe slightly more than half of the new generating capacity in the next 20 years will come from nuclear energy. Two main sources, conventional technologies, what are called light water technologies, and the pebble bed modular reactor. So, in energy, we face a major new challenge. During the course of the year, as I'm sure my team gave you some indication, we will make further announcements on how we intend to develop a nuclear division that can drive this program. This will mean certain changes to the structure of Eskom, not its current activities. Those must continue full steam without any disruption in any way whatsoever. And as was indicated yesterday, we've asked the former Chief Executive Officer, Shilani Tabashi, to head up a major project team that will establish these new areas. This is a very big change for the pebble bed, as was mentioned. We would integrate it into a new structure. It will not go back into Eskom as we know it today. It will go back into a new structure, focusing on and concentrating on nuclear energy. So it's a massive challenge. The importance of the balance sheet, therefore, becomes critical. Just think for a moment, if we were unable to raise around about $150 billion between Transnet, Eskom, and others in the capital markets, we'd have to find it on the budget, and that would have a dramatic effect on the fiscal situation. In fact, it would be devastating for our current macroeconomic position. So I would like to stress that for all their strengths and weaknesses, these companies have to be supported to ensure their integrity, the strength of their balance sheets, because they are an instrument in the developmental state. You say, well, could the private sector do it? The private sector would have been doing it. Everyone could see what was happening. But the private sector will not do it. The programs are too large, the broader risks too macro and too big, and the private sector will only come in to energy production under the umbrella of a well-managed state-controlled enterprise. In Transnet and freight, which is crucial, I think you're all aware of the challenges. There's no way that this economy can grow unless we improve the efficiency of rail freight, of the ports, and we have to invest heavily in increasing the size of the ports. The container traffic in South Africa has dramatically grown at rates never seen in this economy before. We have to adjust to those challenges, and what's pleasing, and it's been a major achievement in my view, if you think back to 2004, we had Transnet in crisis. The prospects of Transnet in 2004 developing a 78 billion rand capital program was zero. But in 2007, we have a Transnet that is possible, can do that. And these are rapid turnarounds that we have to achieve in some of our companies, and it's been quite a challenge to do that. A new challenge that has arisen was not as clearly on the horizon in 2004, but is now, is the stabilization and strengthening of our airline system. SAA is a key player. Replacing SAA by another company, as I've said on many occasions, I cannot conceive that you can do that with any certainty. There is no certainty whatsoever that a company large enough to buy SAA could continue to manage a fleet this big or would want to manage a fleet this big. It may well decide that it's far more lucrative to make South Africa the end point of a global network than to make South Africa the center of the South African airline system. And I think anyone who feels that we're exaggerating that must just keep a very close eye on what's going to happen in the transatlantic routes that started already, but you'll see what the airline industry does under competition. It doesn't comply with strategic objectives of a nation state. It complies with the profit bottom line, and that's quite right. But SAA cannot be a non-profit organization. It has to make a profit. Now, these are quite difficult balances. Maintaining the strategic direction of needing a vibrant airline industry in South Africa, but making sure that you do it in a manner that earns a surplus, makes some profit. Yesterday, the board approved a major restructuring program that still will be brought to the shareholder ministries. We have to liaise, obviously, with other ministries, so we will not make detailed announcements on this for a while. But I'm confident that this offers us a real prospect of turning around the airline industry. And because of the importance of our smaller towns and because of the feeder systems that we need in Southern Africa, particularly with tourism growing and with the build-up to 2010, we've taken the strategic decision that South African Express, which is a very promising airline, would also be held by the state for the foreseeable future. So there are major challenges in the airline industry. It's really very crucial. I think for those of you who have traveled to South Africa's smaller towns, there can be no doubt that it would be a lot better for everybody if we could make those flights more affordable. Now, how do we do that? What do we do? Can we do that in a sustainable manner? I mean, some of the ticket prices to small towns are really astronomical, and this is restricting air travel to a limited number. And I think this is a strategic challenge. There's no ways that we can expect that market forces would do that. But the balance, I keep coming back to this balance. We are not going to do it by subsidizing continuously. We're going to have to do it by creating companies that can earn a profit with a strategic shareholder being the state. The area that we've also become new is the outcome of the joint project facility, which we've now integrated into our budget, as you see, as a fully fledged program, is the whole question of broadband. Now, I'm sure you're all familiar with broadband. This is the bedrock of modern communication. You cannot have modern communication systems, you cannot have modern management systems, you cannot have modern scientific systems without broadband. Broadband is just the ability to move gigantic quantities of information very rapidly indeed. through fiber optic cables and with complex algorithms to arrange the bytes of information. It's fundamental, it's critical. To illustrate the point, we are bidding for the square kilometer array, which is a probe far back to the origins of our universe, to within microseconds of the Big Bang. But we can only do that if we have gigantic broadband capacity, because the amount of information coming into a single telescope array, SKA, is more than a city at any one time. So gigantic amounts of information coming in. And some very exciting new research and development being done here in South Africa on rapid communication systems and new generations of computers. So broadband is essential, and in order to be absolutely certain, with no doubts, no questions, no other boards making the decision, no queries about the long-range benefit of this or otherwise, we decided to keep one of the key broadband systems in state hands so that we can have absolute certainty that we will provide this broadband capacity. We're not forming a new telecommunications company. We're not offering new value-added services. We are just offering high-speed intercity and intercontinental data broadband capacity, which is essential for everything we do. We believe South Africa has fantastic potential in business process outsourcing, but this potential will be severely restricted if we don't have more affordable and more rapid broadband capacity. So these are three key areas in the infrastructure that your committee chairperson, the department, and the boards and managements of the state enterprises are directly responsible for in the different ways that we are responsible for these activities. The area that's emerging as an important area, I would broadly call advanced manufacturing. Strategically, we have kept the Nell in state hands, but as you know, we're forming partnerships with many other companies. Because of the impact it has on our manufacturing sector, because of the amount of skills that are there, and because we have capacity, genuine capacity, to supply some of our key defense equipment needs. So we are seeking to build with the Nell an advanced, stable holding company that would be play a key role in the defense-related industries in South Africa, with international partners and with South African partners. So it's a lot more of a partnership where the strategic direction that we give to Nell will have an impact on the defense-related industries. What we've begun to do, and you would have seen this in the budget presentation, we're now working actively to see how we can use the major investments that are going to be made in Eskom, Pebblebed, Transnet, Denel, Infraco, how we can use these to support the development of South Africa's manufacturing sector. Now, there's an economic logic to this. Over and above a developmental desire, there's a current economic logic which is very powerful. And that is, given the growth of capital goods industries in the world as a whole, and given the demand for capital goods that arises from countries like China, India, Brazil, Russia, securing your supply lines is really very important. I think we've indicated to this committee before that we are in a time where certain major companies around the world do not bid for contracts because they don't have the capacity to meet those contracts. So a small economy like South Africa must be aware of the fact that it will have to take specific steps to strengthen its supply lines for capital goods. If we were to choose to remain entirely dependent on international markets, we must accept that we will then be held hostage to more powerful buyers and more powerful market situations in South Africa. So this is a strategic direction we're taking through this competitive supplier development program and through some very interesting work that's starting to emerge in collaboration with science and technology, CSIR, and other institutes to enhance our research around this kind of activity. The two enterprises then that sit a little outside of this are SAFCO and AlexCorp. We've covered that. as we indicated to you last year in this presentation, we would do a very careful assessment of SAPCO and more particularly of KLS, Komati Land Forests. And we came to the conclusion that KLF, in the first instance, was not large enough to play a strategic role in the timber industry. It's an important asset, and I'll touch on ways that we can protect that asset, but this is not large enough for the state to play a strategic role, and our view was that after a careful assessment, there was not really a need for the state to own KLF, and that we should continue to go back to the original decision and dispose of it. But I think, as the DG indicated yesterday, we have to do that fully cognizant of the previous reason why the deal didn't go through, and that was that the competition authorities, I believe rightly, felt that there would be a concentration within the timber industry if that particular deal had gone through. So we have to design the deal in a manner that avoids those dangers. It seems inevitable, as was indicated yesterday, that we would need to break it into parcels. And dispose of that. But it's a relatively complex deal. We're working very closely with the Department of Water Affairs and Forestry to make certain that both the lease agreement and the license to forestry will ensure that the particular nature of KLS assets, the saw log industry, would be protected, that we don't have major shift in the pattern of production of those assets. The development of forestry, we believe it's better done by the Department of Water Affairs and Forestry, and we are working with them. They take responsibility for it to ensure that they develop a larger program within the Department of Forestry to support the development of afforestation and community involvement in forestry. SAPCO is not the correct instrument for that, and we will move in phases, dispose of KLF, dispose of certain other assets that SAPCO has, and then move the remainder of what's in SAPCO as is appropriate across the Department of Water Affairs and Forestry. In Alex Corp, the state does seek to retain a position in the diamond industry. This is to support in the main the beneficiation process of diamonds in South Africa. And we will use the company Alex Corp for some years to come as an instrument to try and strengthen that position. You are familiar with an agreement signed between Mineral and Energy and De Beers as a result of previous disputes there. But we first have to, with regard to the land mining rights and other land that Alex Corp has, reach a settlement with the community. We did sign a settlement a week or so back. I'm very pleased with that. I think that the community leaders that have driven this process have really both shown tremendous understanding of the mining industry, but great courage as well. I'm absolutely confident in my mind that this is an excellent settlement agreement, which if we pursue it vigorously, which we're prepared to do, could make that community very prosperous. We have had difficulties with the legal processes, and I would be exceptionally disappointed if the legal representatives were in any way to interfere with this deal. I think it would be unfair to the community, because the alternative is very clear. If this settlement agreement is not implemented within the next 2 months, we will have to close the land mining part of Alice Corp, and we'll have to go back to court, which seems to me a very absurd situation to delay things even further for that community. Whereas what we have on the table now is the prospect of a number of companies forming and major compensation paid to the community trust that they could use for their benefit. Let me touch on three final things, Chair, and thank you for this time. I think one of the most important pieces of legislation we would like to be dealing with you this year is the new Shareholder Management Act, or Shareholder Management Model. I'm sure it emerges from what I've been saying now and in previous occasions that we are creating relatively sophisticated enterprises in these state-owned enterprises. These are enterprises that have long-range strategic public interest objectives, but they operate within some of the key disciplines of market competition and of capital markets. Now, this is a pretty complex instrument. Defining the economic targets as opposed to the profit-maximizing targets that you want for an enterprise is a relatively, it's an art as opposed to a science. Because at the same time as you're saying, look, you must meet economic objectives as opposed to profit maximize, you're also saying you must earn a surplus. You must operate efficiently enough to create a surplus. Now, our feeling is that this needs to be more precisely established. You know, who has what power? What is the power of the board? What is the power of the minister? What is, as we've discussed in the ABLE, what is the precise power of Parliament? What role will Parliament play in the establishment or de-establishment of these entities? And who is accountable to who, and who does what? I think it's an exciting development which we've been working on very hard, new aspects of this emerging as we go along. But really we should try and progress this legislation in the course of this year. I think it is an important breakthrough which does a number of things. Firstly, I think it clarifies precisely what Parliament's role is with regard to the establishment of these enterprises and the changes regarding the structure of those enterprises. I think it makes very clear the relationship between the shareholder ministry and the board. This is a very important relationship. You can't expect a company the size of Eskom or Transnet or SAA to operate in very difficult market-related conditions if every 5 minutes some minister pops up with a fresh idea and starts to try and manage the process. You're going to have chaos. With all due respect, you can't have a situation where every 5 minutes brilliant parliamentarians decide they've got an idea that the enterprise should implement. So, Mike is a very, very big word. So, the delineation of these powers of ministers and parliaments and boards is really very crucial, so we have stability and predictability. Two last points. One is that, let me say, as minister, I'm very satisfied indeed. In fact, I'm very proud of the performance of my department. The workload of this department has escalated unbelievably. As we've had to undertake that workload, far more sophisticated negotiations, commercial transactions than we've ever done before. We've had to restructure the department, realign the work processes, and build a new managerial team. And I think we've done very well in the process. I am aware that there are people that have not been happy with it. And there's been a series of comments and leaks that have emerged from the department. I just need to clarify from my perspective as the executive authority in the department, I'm very clear. The Director General is in charge of running that department. She's accountable in terms of law, not me. She's an accounting officer. And people have mechanisms. If they're unhappy, they've got grievance procedures they can take up. If they believe that there's fraud or any other misdemeanor, they've got the whistleblowing facilities that are there, and we put in very tight whistleblowing facilities. But should they choose to leak departmental information outside of those two procedures, they are in breach of their contract. These are people that I would not be prepared to trust one inch, because we deal with some exceptionally sensitive commercial and other strategic information. So I'm afraid that anyone who has not used the proper procedures and attempts to further their cause through inappropriate procedures, contacting people that are not party to any solution to the issue, we will take disciplinary action and take very, very firm disciplinary action against them. I'm personally not prepared to tolerate anybody in my department who's not prepared to use the proper procedure and who feels that their personal interests are more important than what happens in the department. Lastly, let me thank you, a more contentious issue, for asking the question about the board. I gather that there's some dispute about the birth of this question, but let me thank all that gave birth to it, whether it was ANC, DA, or whatever. And then let me apologize and take absolutely full personal responsibility for not meeting the deadlines. But my view is a very clear one. It is absolutely critical that we give you accurate information. That's more important, I regret, than a deadline. Because for a number of reasons. Firstly, what we found was that when we went into the registers that are held by the company secretaries and we tabulated the boards, we found it was very difficult to distinguish in the information they gave us between whether the board was a subsidiary board or a main board, whether this was a dormant company, whether it was an SPV, which in many types of activity you just have SPVs, so you might be a director, but it's essentially one type of activity. And then when we checked it with the CIPGO base, we found inconsistencies. Now, in this parliament, you've had some inconsistencies before between published information and what was in CIPGO, and I don't think it would do anyone any good to repeat that. So, Chairperson, I apologize that we're late, but we will give you the information, but it will be very accurate. There are three things we are now doing. We are ascertaining the precise nature of the board that the person sits on. Is this a main board? Is it a subsidiary board? Is it an SPV? So we can give you some indication, as opposed to a long list of companies, which has no meaning to you whatsoever, that this is the nature of the board. Secondly, what we're doing is to go back and clarify with each board member, what is the company? Are you still on this board? Is it an active company? And thirdly, we've commenced the process, which is a very interesting one and important one, of making certain that our database and that within CIPRO are aligned and correct. We will work flat out on that to give you the information. Let me indicate the approach we take to boards and the number of boards a person can sit on. Now, clearly, when we approach someone to sit on a board, we attempt to ascertain, and after your question, we'll be able to do this more accurately. We attempt to ascertain how many boards they sit on, and we make a judgment call, would this be prohibitive of the efficacy on the board or not? We ask the person, too. Do you believe you can make a contribution? This is what the board does. These days when we approach people, we give them quite a considerable amount of information about the enterprise that we ask them to be on the board for, and we ask them, can you make that contribution? The approach, therefore, I take is after those initial processes that we will judge the performance on the board. And essentially, we have three ways of doing this. One is we can see from the minutes of the board who's participating. Secondly, through consultation with the chairperson, we can ascertain how active people have been. But as part of that process, the state-owned enterprises have introduced, like many other boards in this country, self-evaluation processes. So the boards evaluate themselves. The outside persons come in and help them evaluate themselves. This would be a peer review, asking board members what they think of each other's performance, what they think of the chairperson's performance, what does the chairperson think of their performance, and asking senior executives on a confidential basis, what do you think of the performance of each board member? So those studies clearly are confidential, but the chairperson and myself have access to that, and we can evaluate whether a board has a member has performed or not performed, whether they made reasonable contributions or not made reasonable contributions. And that has influenced some of our choices in recent times on that. And thirdly, in any event, we have a process whereby when we appoint a board, we indicate to the board member that you are appointed for a 3-year period. Subject to, we reserve the right at an AGM to remove you and replace you. And we reserve the right to remove you if you are in breach of your prudential obligations and duties. Thus far, that third one I have not had to do, which I'm not pleased. But we have, from time to time, either because people have been on the board for a long time, or we feel there should be some rotation, or, to be frank, occasionally when there's been non-performance, we have made changes at an AGM. So the approach we take is we will give you the information. We work flat out to give it to you. I've missed 1-month deadlines, 48-hour deadlines, and some of you are very quick to point out. Sorry about about that. I would hope that before the end of this month, and a lot of this depends on how quickly we can line up with CIPRO and how quickly we can get everyone that we've asked in the boards, we're dealing with 30, 40, 50 people, to come back, that we'll give you accurate information. But I take full responsibility. I was not prepared to release the information until I was confident it's absolutely accurate and fair to everybody. So thank you for the question, and sorry we didn't meet the timelines. But I think it's in everyone's best interest that we have an accurate picture of what's happening. And I would stress the approach we take to setting up the boards is the one I've indicated, that we do have, I believe, satisfactory and good mechanisms to monitor the performance of the board members. Let me say that as Minister, I'm exceptionally pleased with the boards we have. I think that they've handled a very, very difficult situation. I think they're doing very well. I think the people sitting on them are exceptionally prestigious people. So we're comfortable, very comfortable with the board that now sit. Anyone can say that you should have better, or that they should be on the board, or someone else should be on the board. What we will judge is over the 2 or 3 year period that we set the objectives for these companies, do they achieve those objectives? And that's what we hold the board accountable for. But thank you for that question. I think it was an important one, and it has helped us and will help us to refine our records, make them more accurate, and be able to keep you more fully briefed on exactly what people are doing on our boards. Chairperson, it's a very, very busy year. You will be busy. There's legislation coming forward. A lot of debates on this legislation, on technical issues, because we are opening new grants with regard to the PFMA, which we are frantically trying to solve. But the legislation will come forward. We have to get these enterprises moving. And thank you very much for the tremendous energy and involvement that this committee puts into the department and to the state-owned enterprises. These are probably some of the largest investment programs South Africa has ever seen. So in a sense, you are kind of not the board. You're a kind of board of one of the biggest investment programs South Africa's ever seen, and I think it's a challenge for all of us. Thank you.
I hope the last second by the minister doesn't lead to a question about if we're a kind of board, how many boards do we members of parliament serve? Thank you very much, Minister. The way we've been going about the process is, each time one of the department officials presents, if you just go back to the 2006 report and say, look, what's happened in the last year, the report, an annual report. But yours is a political overview where it was not specific, like deadlines for dates. But let people think that because you and I come from the same province, I'm being a light monkey. I should just throw one or two things to the attention of the committee. Last year's report, it's very little really. We just want to remind members, it's really for us, our minister, rather than you. 2 points, the minister set on bullet points, how the criteria by which they judge SOE. And when we have the annual report, this is a very good set of criteria, how effectively are SOEs utilizing capital. This is very important to the government's macroeconomic strategy. It's on page 3. I think this is really for us, because later in our report, we say we welcome that. I don't think we've been using this set of criteria, which we need to do effectively enough. So it's really an issue of infrastructure that we need to report on ourselves on, that we're not doing what we said we would do. The Richter's trials last year, you said, the set was very close. Well, we did it yesterday. Congratulate the Ministry and Department and yourself on the settlement. We all hope we had a meeting with the public, the community there shortly. We hope it all goes well. We're a bit worried about things, but we're very pleased to see the progress, and we hope that it will be realized in a court order finally that settles the thing, and we would very much welcome that. On the issue of fast calls, I think there are members who want to raise questions. If they don't, then I'll come back to that. Olivia.com, you reported last year, this is a question I will put directly to you. You said you will not be disposed of as a whole, but part of it may be ring-fenced and sold. And then you listen for so perhaps that's a specific question to you to respond on. Then PDMR was capital in a 2006, you now reported, of course, that it's part of ESCOM, and therefore it will not be a separate standalone SOE. So I take it when ESCOM reports. We feel a bit pleased about at least one less annual report to consider. So frankly, we don't have a problem with that. We also want to discuss Keith, I think you said last year, you said last year there was quite a significant shift on the strategic plan from the previous year. You thought it much clearer and so on. The one issue that you want to introduce, I think it would be appropriate, is the shareholder compact. You said last year, because obviously it was due to the matter of scheduling shareholder compact in Parliament once they are finalized, and you repeatedly said that you rather than you should bring those shareholder compact. What we are suggesting then, in the third quarter, early in the third quarter, before we look at the report, annual report, perhaps we can look at a time where either you and all of you could present the shareholder compact, because it also makes our role more useful and more focused. We reported in 2017 about SAA, but I think members are going to raise that, and you said quite a bit. I won't cover the crowd. And so from last year's report, many of the issues have been addressed, or there's no need to follow up. Mechanically. I then hand over to members to raise issues before I come in.
Let me just briefly respond to some of these because I think it's very useful. I'll link the shareholder compact and the effective use of capital. For those entities like Transnet and Eskom at this point, who raise money on the open capital markets, obviously their rating is critical. The rating is a mechanism whereby the markets judge whether the enterprise is performing and whether it can meet its obligations and whether they're using capital relatively efficiently. So a great responsibility for the department and for the board is to ensure we maintain these very good ratings, because this affects dramatically the cost of capital. If the ratings change, the cost of capital changes. With regard to the companies, the enterprises are not yet entering the open capital markets, we develop in the shareholder compact a number of criteria or measurements or ratios that we ask the board to try and meet as measures of the efficient use of capital. On the shareholder compact, I think it is very useful that we do, as you say, we come in the third quarter. Certain of these precise financial ratios and certain of the precise operating ratios, we may then give you post facto as part of the financial reports, because they can determine negotiating processes. For example, if Eskom and others are entering the capital market, exactly what they tell the capital market must be identical to what anyone else knows. So there's just a technical alignment that we'll do there. But the more you see, and certainly post-facto, you can see everything, but we'll go through the shareholder compact. I really do believe the team and the SOEs have done a very good job on simplifying and making very meaningful these shareholder compacts. On the Rectocell settlement, as I've indicated, I really do hope that we reach a settlement. It would be quite a profound step. There's been a lot of complications on the way. SAPCOM, there may be further questions. Arabia.com, we have done what we indicated in last year, but we've given that task to the two shareholding companies, which is Eskom and Transnet. And essentially, there are certain assets and activities which they see as critical, which they would hold, and we left it to them, and they would dispose of the balance. That process is in process, and it's exactly what we indicated before, that there may be some assets we'd keep back, but others we'd set out. Let me just stress that for CBMR, it remains a separate entity at this stage, so you've got more work to do. The formation of the new divisions that we're looking at will not be done overnight. Our target is to do it inside a year, maybe 18 months. So this is a process, and it's not a matter of, as you know now, technically, DevilBit is an unincorporated joint venture within Eskom. We will hold it in its current form for a while, and when we've got clarity on exactly how we structure the new divisions of Eskom, particularly the nuclear division, we will then do the redeployment of PVMR back into those divisions. So it will take a bit of time. It's not something that's immediate. And SAA, as you indicated, there would be some questions and shareholder compact. We follow your proposal.
Thank you very much. Peter, is Hannah. Yeah.
chairperson, I was going to remind you firstly to maybe you want to reiterate your congratulations of the ministry and the introduction to the budget with regard to the change of the purpose of the department. Well, I thought I'd remind you because it was very well done yesterday. Thank you. Just a couple of points. The minister, we as a board have said before that you've got an excellent team in your department and so on. And as far as that is concerned, we've never had problems. So just for the record, to say that again. We do have concerns from time to time about issues, and we've always felt able to raise those concerns directly with the people concerned. With regard to the question of the directorship, I mean, you've preempted some of what we said yesterday. But the reason this question was asked, it initially arose in Skopje, when one of the ANC members there brought up the number of directorships that board members of SAA hold. And we thought it important enough to follow up, because you, the DG, and others have continuously stressed the importance of the board when it comes to the management of companies, where our role ends, where the board's role ends, and management the day-to-day. So they have a particularly important job in terms of representing us. And we know that you do change boards from time to time. Whole boards, as we've noticed with one of the SOEs in the past, a few years ago, or most of them. But when we ask the question also, I think it would be good if you give us a breakdown of the type of board that these people sit on. But part of asking it also is, there's a question of time. How much time do you need? How many meetings do you have to attend? How much reading do you have to do? So whether I'm on an NGO, whether I'm on a non-profit organization, I still have to go and attend a meeting. We have in the past had trust, very prestigious trust, with very wonderful people on there, who were put there because they were icons, but never had time to get involved in the day-to-day running of what those trusts were. So that is why we ask the question. I think you, in your own experience and your department will know that, I think that as a committee, we've taken our responsibilities very seriously. We've not been looking for sound bites. So when we ask, it's because we generally have a concern about issues. So I'm sure that you will accept our bona fides in that, and we will await the info as soon as possible. You will also notice, Minister, that we haven't expressed an opinion on the number of boards of persons should sit on, because we're waiting to get the factual position first. Can I say, with regard to...
If TGA could just deal with the fourth issue at one go, wouldn't you?
Okay.
And we'll come back to you. So are there any specific... I didn't mention, Minister, your letter, which I have a copy of here, written to explain. It reached us on the 26th of April, good money, and I'll see a copy. But there was, I explained that. If anybody else wants to raise issues about the board, members, number of boards people serve on, who are also on the SOE board. Any questions? No. Okay. Can I just raise a related issue? You see, it goes back to the point you made about as the role of the SOEs becomes more complex and the magnitude enhances and so on, the issue also arises, also you said the delicate balance, it's not a science, I think it's more enough, not almost only enough, of profit maximization, and given that mental goal, the social, long-range socio-economic objectives, and how to find the balance. And then the question becomes, what is the role of each of the stakeholders, the board, the ministry and department, parliament, and so on? Now, you see, that the issue, as I remember, I was not there, that arose in Skopje, isn't this correct? If people are saying SAA is the highest place, right? Is that the view of Skopje? And the question was, what is the board doing about it? So that's where it arose, isn't it? It's actually a context of how much of responsibility for SAA's difficulty resides with the management and think about the board. And I think their feeling was the board's the problem. And then, of course, the context was, you know, the Fidentia crisis. So I mean, we learned that the powerful figures are 81 boards. So. But it is something, you know, that in the shareholder management, but I think, will become clearer. What is the role of the board? I think what Peter is saying, if I'm correct, not the number of boards you serve on, as much as, you know, as you say, the what such a role. And why we're talking about the share of the management stock, we, you know, the first draft came to us. It was fine. It wasn't a draft. It was a concept. I think the woman was in. Her name, I don't know if she was in. Anyway, she came, no, it wasn't actually a lawyer. Anyway, the woman that came, we told her, you know, this idea of concept doesn't mention anything about the role of Parliament. And if the role is yesterday, you see, the question is, the teaching is, what is the role of Parliament? I'm not saying we discuss it now, but what I'm getting towards saying in a very verbose way is we actually want a workshop before the bill comes. And we prefer you to be there, not to be blind. There are some political issues that arise which the DG, like every DG, cannot fully answer because they are broader political issues. So we may think this workshop should also fit in with your availability because we said then, what is the role of Parliament? And the DG raised it again. You've raised it with us also. It is, what is the role of the committee in respect of oversight over the department as distinct from oversight directly over SOE? Now, the consensus tentatively we arrived at, it was like a truce also, was our role is to have primary, or this is how I describe it, there were a few occasions I've asked outside the meeting. Our role is primarily oversight over the department, whose role is oversight over the SOE. But an anomaly arises because in the PFMA, the annual report is submitted to us as a portfolio committee. And then the department is present there as well because some of the issues that arise are about the department not fulfilling necessarily its oversight role effectively. But fundamentally, they deal directly with the SOE. And you know our reports, they deal directly with the SOE. So you can't say that our report is wholly, our oversight role is wholly over the department. Because PMMA says the report is to Parliament and we've got to respond to that. So we need to find a balance, again, to use the words. I think it's more on us than the science than that. But that is an issue that maybe we can clarify in law. Because you'll move on, I'll certainly move on. You know, as you can tell by the way I change meetings, I'm utterly bored at one level. But in any case, the fact of the matter is we just need to clarify it in the firm. We don't know what's there. But it will help to have you present as well at the workshop. So in short, I've been very verbose, unduly so. But I think there are two things. One is the board and the context of it. And two is that the issue that may be addressed and the relationship also that politics and energy in that progress is any issue.
Chair, very briefly, let me just again reiterate. I'm really very, very pleased that you asked the question. I think it's exactly the right question, both Scopa and yourself, to widen it. I think it's great. It's really forced us to do a lot of good homework, and it's great. So I absolutely respect your bona fides in it, and my apologies for delays. I've motivated. Some interesting points that arise, and I support the proposal for a workshop because we are breaking some new ground here. A few things. One is that one of the difficulties we've actually faced with SAA is that it was a subsidiary board of Transnet. And that was really a problem because, and you'll recall when I motivated why we're separating it, I said that one of the reasons we're separating is we can't easily see that one board can oversee such diverse activities at such a critical time. So that's why we needed to separate it. And if you've been watching this process, you will see that we strengthened the board quite markedly when we began the separation process. Now, one of the challenges you face is that, yes, SAA is facing real challenges, no doubt about it. And you've got to bring experienced people onto it. You're not going to find the sort of experience that we have brought onto that board with people that don't sit on other boards. Now, whether it's too much, too little, we discussed that previously, and really it is, I think, an art. You've got to do it by assessing. And the solution is not to try and be precise on that art of deciding beforehand, but to make sure that you can correct things if you've been wrong. So if you've chosen somebody and you find they're not putting the energy in, can you correct it? And I think that's quite an important emphasis. But the sort of people we have sitting on the board now are very, very senior business people. And you need them. You need them for this experience. I should just say something also that you might have been picking up, which I think has been an interesting experiment and I think a positive one. What we've tried to do in the knowledge that these boards are important and we need in the future more board members. If you watch closely, and I'll always identify the people, you'll see we always try and include some people that are relatively new on board. And new mainly because of their youth. So we've tried to bring these people in, I think very successfully, frankly. It's been very exciting. The other thing we've done, and you've been watching this, I'm sure, is that in order to spread our reach and contact with Africa, we've brought some very senior Africans onto our board. And again, I think it's been a very interesting, very important experiment. It's a two-way street. It allows us to look into Africa through some very knowledgeable, experienced people, and it allows them to look into South Africa in some of the key players. So we've got on SAA, on Eskom, on Transnet, we've got not only Africans but international people. And that's the third area we've done. On each of the big boards, all of our boards, so we would have a mixture. You've got specific skills you need. If our problem in SAA is mainly finance, strengthen the finance. But you'll see always that there's some experience, there's some relative newcomers, young people, there's some people from Africa, and there's some international experience. And that is new. It's the first time we ever did that was a few years ago in Eskom, but we've now done it more generally. And it creates a lovely platform, I think, of people. But we'll keep watching this process. We can assess this talk, and I think you've raised the right question. My own view on Parliament, Department, etc., is we have the workshop. But I think it's a pragmatic situation that's relatively simple. It's fundamental that the annual reports of the SOEs come to Parliament, because that's the only way you can assess whether we do our job. You've got to see those. Your direct line of control, I think, Chairperson, you're quite right with us. And basically, the important thing is that the recourse you have for any problems you see in the SOEs is back through the executive and through the department. You have no direct recourse. You can't instruct the board to do this or a chief executive to do that. So if you feel that the problem lies with the department, you raise this point forcefully, get into the debate, and eventually the president says, this minister's useless, let's kick him out. Or you criticize us in Parliament here. But the recourse channel must just be clear. The recourse channel is back through the executive and the board. But I think it's an art that we shouldn't worry too much about. I mean, the more you look at everything, the more questions you raise, it's great. The public process, it's useful for it to happen. What we can refine is exactly what you both said, you and Peter said, Chair. The steps, the decision-making points, the times, the processes, if we can clarify that more in the Shareholder New Act, it helps everybody. So there must be clarity that certain decisions are taken at this point in time in the following process. That's how it's done. Not through some whim of a minister or whim of a parliamentary committee or whim of a board or something like that. So I really think we can get an excellent situation here. And the emphasis that I would place is that the more, if information is to be made public, if you should make more information public in the state-owned enterprises, that we must do. And that Parliament should be the first place that we come to with information, because you're the most direct representatives of the public. But I think we can manage this thing in a very exciting way.
Back to you, Peter, and then we'll pick up on the others.
Yeah. Chairperson, with regard to South African Airways, I mean, we wholeheartedly agree with you that it's a strategic asset and that it's important to the development of the country that it remains such. But now, you know, the restructuring of SA seems to have almost become an annual event. Every year, we are in a restructuring. When we ask questions, we get told it's a legacy issue. Somewhere along the line, the legacy is going to have to stop, because the next CEO, whoever that may be, whenever, can also turn around 5 years from now and say, well, it's a legacy issue. Though. Sometimes we don't get the forthright kind of answer that we should be getting from SA. But that's just as an aside. When you talk of South African Express remaining in Saint Anne, especially for feeding the smaller towns like Nelson Mandela, Metro. Pricing is important. Pricing is very important. And there again, I know you say that we shouldn't be subsidizing everything, but I think we need to find a way. I don't know how, but I'm trying to get a cost of finding some way of making air travel more affordable to the smaller places. I mean, every time you open a newspaper, you see SAA has got a special, Mango's got a special, Cape Town, Joburg, Durban, and nothing for the rest of the country. So we must find a way. Another thing with regard to those planes are the size of the plane. Some of us have been slightly bigger over the years. Those planes are very, very small that apply to computers. But what is the other question? What is the possibility of South African Airways and South African Express being one company? Is it philosophical, perceptual? Is it in terms of the way they operate in the market they service? Would it not be make sense that they operate as one state-owned entity? And then there's Mango also, which is also servicing a different thing, also owned by the state, operated and overseen by different people. Where does that fit in? Should these things not all be one thing and form one package? And the question also with regard to Mango, I don't know if it's time to ask now, maybe later in the year, annual reports, is it operating efficiently? Is it operating profitably? And when we ask about profitability, we're not just talking about cash flow. I mean, we know, for example, when Mango launched, it sold 40,000 tickets. So there's 40,000 times so many rands that came immediately. There would have been a lot of cash. Is it operating profitably as it's expected to be? And then again, the question of SA and profit. Yes, you don't want to run a welfare airline. And it should be profitable, but to what extent should it be profitable? Should it be profitable only in terms of its operating expenses? Or with the government from time to time providing capital for capital expenses, you know, to buy additional planes and so on? You know, how do we find the balance between the developmental goals of government and the profitability of the airline? And then just two other things, Shepard, and just as an aside with regard to railways and freight moving. Lots of questions. Anybody else want to get to the SA? We'll come back.
Yeah.
Yeah, Mani?
Shepard, yeah, thank you very much. I've got three questions here on the SAA. To you, Shepard. First of all, I want to ask the Minister, why is the agreement between SAA and Mango? Why is it not to the disposal of the general public? Secondly, Minister, you mentioned earlier today that SAA can't be taken over with certainty. What do you mean by that exactly, Honourable Minister? Then my third question, Chairperson, is the Minister also referred to the importance of more services and more affordable services to the rural areas and smaller cities in South Africa. And you then mentioned that there's an importance for private companies to then come into the process with the government as strategic shareholder. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that, Minister, and can we see this as a point of departure, a new way to privatization? Thank you, Chair.
Does that then don't you think that to your senior political and otherwise? I'm talking about the senior political and also the senior but I just want to check with the minister around the issue of SAA. Forgive me, I'm a slow thinker sometimes. You see, Chen, last year report, there was a strategy which was developed and was supposed to be implemented, but yesterday, the minister today has indicated that there's another turnaround. We still have to go through the normal processes to be approved by the board and so on. What does that mean to the last year's strategy? Does that mean that one is in the apostle? A new one is in the developed? I just need a clarity around that because this is just needed a clarity around that, so that one is clear. The other issue says that if you follow the discussion or during the scope, there was an indication that indeed SAE seems to be having a 10% share in Airlink. What exactly happened? You see, share was those shares in Airlink. Airlink is also feeding SAE currently. Like, no, Nelspread is not the express, there only 2 or 5 in Airlink. But Airlink is dominating that route to Nelspread. How do we use, because SAA is an SOE, how does we use that shareholding in Airlink to deal precisely with what the minister is taking, the eco prices? Because you see from Nelspread, it's already close to 2,000, 1,900 or 1,800, depending when you make a booking. So how do we use or leverage that shareholding in Airlink to keep that would be possible, also to deal with the issue of the prices? Because to me sometimes I don't understand or because maybe that you find express and airlink, the other flight is leaving 10 minutes, 5 minutes before, and the other one is empty, the other, you know, but you also share on the other one if you are following, you know. I don't understand how does it work. It seems that we need to have a broader strategy. We check our stock at what are we having as a state, each and every of those different airlines, and how to efficient and utilize that so that you are able to deal with the, also with the issue of prices and so on. The other issue is that you have been following this debate of the airlines, one point as SAFM, where some of the CEOs from Kudula and the other one will be taking. I think they put the issue beyond any reasonable doubt that you see it doesn't matter who owns SAA. The issue is to fix it. You can fix it within government ownership. It doesn't matter whether it's a private company or not. The issue that is, are we getting a correct strategy to deal with the problem in the SAA? And surely, I think as the minister indicated in terms of the board, one hope that that will change the whole issue of SAE. But I'm just interested in this strategy of last year and the new one, how does they link up around that particular issue?
Sir, I'm slightly covered by the young man on my left. In terms of where to be. I want to clarify in terms of where to be. So on SAA and the strategy and the turnaround strategy as well. I'm trying to understand, say also, is the issue around the strategy itself, or is the issue around who has to implement the strategy? So that we don't over and over again change strategies and yet the problem is not with our turnaround strategy, but rather the people who have to implement the strategy. The experience to some degree has proved that. And therefore, Chair, I'm also concerned about the strategy that was there previously and the new strategy that has to go through a process currently. Especially on when you look at the what was on the newspapers and the media recently on SAA. And also to check maybe it's something that will also be dealt with in the processes that have been outlined. This issue which we have raised as the committee on the salary pact of senior managers in the SOE. And it has arisen again in the newspapers around SAA in the midst of all the problems that are there in terms of the management of the running of the enterprise itself. Yeah, that's what I wanted to say with relates to SAA, but I have other questions on that.
Just two quick things. I mean, many people have said almost too much. Just one quick thing.
You see, from the vantage point of a minister of the department, obviously you see SAA in a particular way. You interact with them the way you do and so on. So I just want to remind you, Mr. Ashwal, we meet SAA once a year. And quite frankly, I think people have been quite diplomatic as well. I'm just surprised at how careful people have chosen. But the truth is, you know, each time that appears, I mean, you have to be quite frank, if the CEO comes to see us, there's an issue of credibility. Also, if you look around, the media, you know, sometimes it's a nail on the head, so to speak. I mean, figuratively. It's been raised that the current CEO has been there for some 2 years or more. And, you know, some of the things that are emerging in the newspaper, like the Tripoli, whatever, consultant, even people like us who are not familiar with the area, wonder why some decisions have been choose for, you know, like, other Janelle's done similar things, Frontex has done what they've got operating divisions. To check exactly where the profits are being made and where the losses are being made. It's some suggestion that some of them enter into public-private partnerships, some might be privatized and so on. In other words, in short, this new proposal that's going to emerge on strategy in a month's time, A, the point that these are going to make, there's no relationship between that necessarily and the strategy that we had in the previous year and the one that changed again last year. That's the trouble. Two is, what's so fantastically new about what people, if the figures are correct, to say that couldn't have been thought of before? And as a portfolio committee, well, I'm certainly sorry to say this, Minister, and I'm a bit worried to press this together, but let me just go with carefully. We're from world-class Italy. People have swung around to the south of cities now. You know, people even said, okay, we made no profits this year, we ain't taking any, what you call bonuses and so on. So in other words, in the same space of 2 weeks, we have these extremes. So we're also influenced by what this country is capable of when we judge. And we don't want to compare because they're very different industries. They've got very different legacies. The volatility of fuel prices doesn't apply to some of the SOEs. So bearing all that in mind, from the vantage point where we sit, what are we conveying to you? Obviously, from the vantage point you sit in, you have a different picture in front of us, is that actually we are worried about SAA. And we actually think that, we hope this time around there's a stable, sustainable strategy, but more important, that the people who are there to implement it and the content are the right people.
Thank you, Chair. The first question was, we agreed to strategic assets and all the turnaround annual event. Let's look at a few things. Firstly, for SAA, the hedge book situation absorbs a tremendous amount of cash and capital. So one of the biggest problems that we face in SAA is very low capital-based capital ratios. And it's difficult to build these up again quickly. This is no doubt has been a major problem. The notion that the $6 billion was pumped in as cash as capital is not correct. It's a complex operation done to unwind a hedge book. And the main beneficiaries of that were not SAA's balance sheet, but Transnet's balance sheet. And that was deliberate. We needed to strengthen Transnet's balance sheet. I think in hindsight we moved a little bit too far in one direction, but hindsight is perfect science, it's not the time. So we start out with a difficult position in SAA right at the beginning. The immediate responsibility that we gave to the board and to the chief executive was to cut costs. So if you watch SAA, its passenger numbers are rising, its revenue is rising. The problem that we have is definitely in the cost structure. So the project that I think Chris was talking about, or Eric was talking about, was the Bambanani project, essentially a cost cutting. That continues. That project continues. But the experience was clear that by itself that was not enough. You needed a much more surgical re-engineering of the airline. You needed to make much bigger changes. So the process of Bambanani was one where SAA would remain as its previous form. We tried to cut costs. What became evident was that you couldn't do that. You had to make far bigger changes in the structure of SAA. And the strategy that we're working on now can be fairly easily summarized. firstly that you need to simplify the corporate structure and make various divisions more accountable, and we look to bring in partners. So we're looking to bring in partners into the freight section, into the technical section, and we will dispose of assets that we think are non-core. That takes a little time to look at and be clear on. If you think about it, we're very much in the same process as the Danel was a year back. In Danel, we were able to move more quickly, it was easier, it's a different industry. In SAA, it's a much more complex industry. So, simplify the structure, get rid of non-core, concentrate your management's attention on running the airline or running the freight or making sure that the technical continues to perform. Now, let me stress, SAA, there's no question in my mind whatsoever, it's a good airline. It's got a very good reputation, its technical safety record is excellent, it's got a fantastic pilot corps, it's got exceptionally good staff, and its service levels rank with any in the world. So you're dealing with a good airline here. But what is missing, which many airlines around the world have discovered, and I'll come back to that, is you actually have to make a pretty major set of changes, structural changes, in the operating methods of SAA to bring down the cost so that the rising revenue we've got is beneficial. So, the second thing we did do, and this was important, and this was a shareholder responsibility, we sat back and said, look, we should tell the SAA board exactly what we want this airline to be. Do we want it to compete with all the world's airlines? Or what is it? And we said, no. No, it's like the same decision as Danel. We said, no, we're not going to try and compete with all the world's giant airlines. What is SAA best at? Now, what SAA is quite obviously best at is servicing our major cities and servicing Africa and creating a link with other continents. So the board can now work within a framework which says you must reach out to major cities of other continents. But we're not going to try and service every city around the world. Now, this is going to cause some unhappiness with some people. Some will say you should be flying to us because we're important, and why are you not flying to us? So, in essence, internationally, we will focus on those routes that work and put our energy into them, and where the routes are possibly could be made profitable, we'll work hard to make them profitable. Where it's obvious that they're not going to be profitable, we'll stop them or form partnerships with our Star Alliance or co-chair or do others. So we've given much greater clarity to the board exactly what we want them to do. Now that means that SAA then concentrates on the more heavily traded routes. That's international, Africa, and in South Africa too. So we're not going to try and service every one of the giant metropoles like Nelson Mandela and that all the time. We're going to service the main routes. And Nelson Mandela Metropole is a borderline. It's a borderline. We'll have to watch it closely, see what happens. Hopefully you guys will find more on SAA. So SAA will service the cities of Africa and service links to major international cities in the different continents. We've got to focus on what works at this stage. We can't carry on focusing on unprofitable airlines. And then we will introduce a range of cost-cutting, re-engineering measures. I wouldn't listen to the speculation in the press. People are getting half-cocked reports, half-leaked, etc. The process is a complex one. It's not a big new strategy. It's taking the former cost-cutting one and adding critical elements to that, because we realize that you've got to go deeper into the structure of the airline if you really want to correct it. And a very important thing, the success of the Danel strategy as we implemented was the clear decision that you can't play in the international arms system industry. And we're saying to SAA, look, you're essentially an African carrier. You're not a big global player, you're an African carrier. And let's make it a successful African carrier that reaches out to the rest of the world. So, you know, these are important strategic processes that we can look at. We're dealing with the operation of the airline is not a problem. It operates well, it's technically very sound, it's a series of cost cutting. Now, what we then did was to turn to the most recent successful example of a major similar restructuring, which is Air Canada. So the benefits we get from Seabreeze is not that they come with all magic and newness. with this that they come fresh from a very, very, very similar exercise. And there's advantages in that. I think it's been very useful indeed. Within months, we did some factors which, frankly, had not been thought of before. One was a very, very important one, which is why you're all going to get letters and lobbied by everybody, and you're going to have a lot of, as we implement this strategy, you guys are going to be lobbied left, right, and center. But we introduced the cash conservation strategy. So people don't just have a budget that they can sign and spend money. It goes to an official centralized office and says, no, can't spend that money. Big impact. But all those suppliers that were getting a nice, easy ride, supplying excess stocks and things like that, are going to be very unhappy. So when we implement this process, there will be unhappiness. Now the most important thing we have to do, which is why we'll move smoothly and in a measured way, we must take the employees and the unions with us. Now, they know, we know that we're in a difficult situation. But they are the key. You can't run SAA without our pilot corps, without the technical engineers, without the excellent ground staff that we've got and crews that we've got. So they must come with us. So the process will be implemented. Are the right people implementing? Well, I can't think of any better. If I do, we'll put them in. But for the moment, I'm quite confident that we can do this. You need rough and ready people to implement something like this. You need pretty thick skin. Because there's no one, everyone's an expert on SAA. And rightly so, everyone criticizes it all the time. So we have to implement the strategy. If we don't, we won't have SAA. So very, very simple. Very, very simple. Everyone knows that. I certainly will have no hesitation if we don't succeed in the next 2 years. It will be my lot to take the key decision and say, sorry, Mr. Shareholders are not prepared to back up anything. We can do this. This is a very good airline. We can turn it. The cost cutting measures will be done sensibly, but systematically. And this is the correct, your point. We're not going to chop and change. So what was called Bambanani, we're just deepening it. And we're adding certain critical strategic directions to it that I've indicated. You're an African airline. Bring in partners, simplify the structure, and drive very, very hard. We will negotiate retrenchment. I think it's inevitable there will be. No one should speculate about amounts or anything at the moment, but there's a negotiating process. And we're going to work very hard to back the board and the airline to do it. And this is a new board, as I indicated. It's a tough board, and we're going to implement this, and I think we can do it. How do we make regional traffic more affordable? By densifying the routes, by putting more aircraft in. Now, an important point I want to make, we must be very supportive of the competition in the South African airline sector. It's very important, and we as government are very supportive of a strong Comair, of a nationwide. These companies, of Kalula, one time, that we must have this. It would be a disaster to try and crush all that competition. So we're very supportive of the Competition Commission watching us closely. These are issues that are crucial, because the more competition you have, the better. Now, what our problem is that on some routes there's very little competition. So how do we create more competition? How do we do that? What should we do? Now, the choices about should SAA still have a thing in SA Airlink, these are strategic issues we have to begin addressing. There's no doubt in my mind that the links that SA Airlink has with the branding of SAA is positive for them. Do we keep that? In what form? Do you combine SA Airlink and SA Express? This is a positive. These are all issues that we must now get down and look at more closely. You're very right. The choice of airlines is critical. What is the most efficient set of airlines to use on these regional routes? Do we continue with the smaller Embraer fleet and Airlink, the Dash fleet and SAX? Do you bring in props, the Bombardier Choir? The cost of an airline on these routes is absolutely critical. Should we add slightly bigger aircraft to SA Express and allow it to service Nelson Mandela? These are issues that we'd have to look at. But as we do that, we've got to be acutely conscious all the time that the Competition Tribunal and Commission will not let us collude on these matters. And they're right. You can't collude on these things. You must keep the competition going. You've got to keep this thing moving. So these are not simple choices. We've motivated the no-cost mango before. And I think the rule of thumb that seems the most sensible one is one set of management should concentrate on your heavily traded route. So Mango is not going to go flying to all sorts of little towns. It's a heavily traded route airline. It goes where people have to move. It doesn't go to small places. It goes to big places. SAA is a heavily traded route airline, not a small airline. SAA Express is a different kind of airline, trading a different route system, other things. Now there can be some synergy. Everyone's pointing to this, and this is one of the benefits that Airlink and Express have by operating on some common platform. These synergies we shouldn't lose, I think it's just useful. We'll see what Mango does at the end of its first year. You're right, you mustn't get blinded by cash. We'll have to see exactly what's happening. Cash-wise, it's doing well. I think the current indications are it should probably expand. But these are matters we should look at when we digest the first year's performance. I think it's done well for the low-cost sector. I mean, I think it brings more people into low-cost generally. And we should encourage that, really. And I very much hope that the other low-cost airlines remain there. SAA, we must return it to profitability and stability. We've got too much on our plate in South Africa that we can't keep pumping capital into the airline. So we've got to make critical injections now that stabilize it and give it a chance to move forward and run profitably. We can't just work on the assumption, well, next time you have a problem, we'll put capital in. We need that capital for so many other things. And we've indicated, I see that the letter that I wrote to the board and that they shared with staff was leaked to the media, but we've indicated very clearly the capital injections will come provided we implement the restructuring, provided we implement the restructuring, that the cash that's injected cannot go to anything other than capital expenditure and implementing the restructuring. Can't go to anything else. Yeah. So we've been very clear on that, and I think we've got the support of the staff, and we'll keep driving it really very hard. Money, the SA Mango agreement, I mean, this is an agreement between a subsidiary and a holding company. We wouldn't expect Comair to make public its agreement with Kalula, just like ours, we're not going to make public. These are commercial agreements. This relates to the commercial operation of the airline, and the rule that I apply and we apply is that if things are commercially sensitive, they remain commercially sensitive. They don't float around in the public. You know. So I said, you said SAA can't be overtaken. What I said is we cannot be certain that anyone who takes over SAA would continue to keep it the size it is. Now, SAA is not a small airline. It ranks in the top 20 in the world. It's not a baby. So whoever took over SAA has to be big. If it's banks with that kind of money, they're going to maximize profit. If it's one of the big global carriers, they're going to maximize route profit. So we have no certainty whatsoever what they will do with SAA. Absolutely no certainty. That's the point I'm making. I've got a lot more. If a small airline, you probably can say, well, roughly this is what they're going to do, maybe. But strategically, we think it would be a fatal error to allow SAA to be absorbed into the route systems of a much bigger airline at this point. Particularly the uncertainty that we're going into with 2010. If I'm an international airline, I'm only interested in servicing the major routes, and that's what I'm going to do. Particularly if I've got a new competition clash on my Atlantic route. I remember the airline industry key is the transatlantic route. I've suddenly got the prospect, real prospect of open skies. Do you think I'm going to put my energy into? Energy into some corner of Africa? I'm going to put my energy into the transatlantic route. So in that kind of uncertainty, as a shareholder, we're saying, no, this is a bad time strategically. Let's strengthen this airline. Let's get it back on its financial feet and get it moving. Revenue-wise, operating-wise, fine. The balance sheet is weak. The balance sheet is weak. And to get the balance sheet strong, we have to completely restructure the cost base of that airline. Across a wide front, this is not some shortcut that lets retrench a few people and everything will be solved. This is a whole restructuring of the airline. Your last question, I think, really related to something I was saying about the NEL. What I said about the NEL is that the NEL would be held by the state, and we would then have partnerships in subsidiaries below it. Now, you're correct in this sense that in SAA it's similar, that SAA would be held by the state, but if we form a partnership in technical or cargo, we bring in partners. We'll bring in partners. Those partners will be chosen for strategic reasons, not for financial reasons, for strategic reasons that they bring to those businesses strategic benefits in the form of technical expertise, operating expertise, or market access in one or other way. I think the SAA Air Link, I'm trying to indicate, we've got to make a choice on it, but with 10% you can't influence what they would be charging. And then, you know, running an airline on small routes, relatively small, is quite expensive. So the only way we can really bring these costs down is to somehow get the air route system better managed, bring more aircraft on, strengthen these enterprises. It's quite a challenge because definitely it's in our interest to get more air traffic going. You say it doesn't matter. If I was the chief executive of one of the competitive airlines, I would say that about SAA. But in fact, I think it matters a great deal who owns it as to how you choose to fix it. And that's the point we're making. We're saying that, no, state needs to own this because we want to fix it in a particular way. If you allow someone else to own it, they'll fix it in a different way. And as I just indicated, we're not certain what the outcome of that would be. Like we've got in all of this SOE activity, it's a balance. We can fix, but if it starts to cost too much to fix, we have to get out. And that would be quite a sad blow for the airline industry in South Africa. I think that we're comfortable with the people that have to implement it. What we have to do, which is important, we have to do it. And there's going to be a lot of unhappiness as we do this. You are going to be lobbying this side and center. The board's going to be unpopular. The chief executive and his management will be unpopular. This is a difficult, difficult process. And our job in public enterprise is to give full backing to the process. Your job is to see how we're doing, ask questions, comment, and if we're doing it wrong, tell us. But really, we've got confidence that we can do this and that we've got the right team, and we must keep that team and give them all the support. On the salaries of state-owned enterprises, we have been working very closely with all of them to develop a more systematic, common approach to the salary structure of state-owned enterprises, which we will also bring to Parliament. These are some of the biggest companies in South Africa. You must pay the executives market-related salaries. On the bonus issue, the confusion was that I signed a document, which I shouldn't have, because we had the wrong date in the wrong box. But if you put the right date in the box, the solution is fairly clear. So it's not a major issue. It just shows that I should wear my glasses sometimes when I sign. Credibility? Of course. This is absolute. This is the key challenge. You've hit the nail on the head. The key challenge facing us with SAA is this time we're better. How we're going to do and push it and go. I've indicated why we brought Sebring in. I think it's been an exceptionally useful exercise. I really would not. You've got access to us if there's an issue you really need to know. Let me tell you. Half-cock leaks. When you restructure things, I can promise you now, as I said to the union, I said, one thing I can promise you, you're going to start leaking information from that airline. I guarantee you'll do it. And it happens. So we can't work on the leaks and the moans and the groans. It's going to be a pretty tough process. You've got direct access to us. We can give you what the facts are, and I think it's important. We're all worried about SAA. It's the toughest, probably one of the toughest turnarounds we've got because it's such a volatile industry. I mean, defense is tough. But, you know, defense contracts are lost for years. Airlines, something can go wrong in 2 weeks. Yeah. 1 week can set back your revenue in 1 week. This is a roller coaster stuff. This is exciting stuff. So, we must turn it around. I'm confident we will. It's a very important asset. We'll give full support to the board and management to do it. Imagine trying to turn around SAA and you've got a minister saying, well, I'm not quite sure you're the right people to do it. I wouldn't even start the process if someone like that were existed. So we're going to do it. We've got the right people. We've got the right board. We've got the right management. We'll build up more expertise in that management. But this is a very good airline that we can turn around. Remembering that it has not been fully capitalized. This is the first real capital injection we put into it. And you know, it's a very low capital injection. So this is a tight squeeze that we've got.
I just need to draw members' attention. You're 20 minutes beyond time. The tea is there. And I think you've got another meeting. Can we just, for the purposes of just signal very quickly the question, and we can find some other way of processing 5 minutes. What are the other questions you had? I don't know. You can reply if you want to. But other people have their hand up. Robert?
Sir, my question is in relation to the KLM's position that we are taking. In fact, I think in the foreign our position was little bit influenced previous, I think last year, by our experience. That we're getting from the privatized forest. And then because we indicated that there is some problems that are being experienced in the area of the stock auction and also in the area of production, which is affecting then the economic growth of the country and also the industry as a whole. And I asked by then, when beginning to say, the forestry is becoming the strategic industry. But now I thought also that that is going to go also to cover the KLM position. I understand what was happening in that area when it was the privatization was stopped due to various problems that were there in parliamentary approval. But I thought also that the review that we were making was also covering KLM also. But I just want to be clear now as to whether what is going to happen. Because if we take the area of our export, the role that has been played by the forestry in that area, I thought it's going to be regarded as a strategic industry because of the participation that is very closely engaged by the forestry industry.
Thank you. Minister, with regards to the disposal of the forestry, what should we remember that within these forests there are communities living, and these communities, I mean, have been there for quite some time, and they've got land rights. The minister pointed out that you've got a relationship with the Department of Water Affairs, and then just you work closely with Land Affairs as well, so there's quite a few land rights in that resources. And please, if possible, for this whole exercise to be of involvement as well, this community is living in the forest. And then also, you know, while this whole proposal is taking, these communities are dependent on Tesco and to provide services like water and food and make sure that these services are continuous. Thank you.
It's a matter which I raised last year, but at that point the response was this fire, which occurred around the area of Mpumalanga. But I just want to check what would be the intent. Because currently what was happening was that they were using quotas in terms of spreading the dogs. And surely those quotas out of the first phase of the process that the new owner of those forests, when they were selling the logs, the quotas were removed in such a way that the local sawmill could no longer have access to logs, because initially there were quotas to say you can sell this much, export this much, and then this much will remain local before the sawmill. Now immediately when those forests went to the private hands, then those quotas were removed. As a result, in my constituents and next to my constituents, we've got quite a number of people have been retrenched because the sawmills are no longer receiving the saw, the logs, because the new owners, they just say, go wherever you want to, want to maximum profit, will export this thing and so on. How is this process? Because last year when you said the 14 was that they looked towards also retaining this one, I thought that maybe may also try to deal to a certain extent with that problem, but we have of course indicated that it's only a few hectares, this one cannot have impact on that, but how do we intend to deal with this problem, because really, people are losing jobs on daily basis, and so it's becoming a very ugly issue. So,
I'll just say a few things. I don't think we expect the minister to reply fully. I'm just signaling to him. So in the report, we won't cover it fully unless the minister replies in general. But just to pick up on SAFCO, one of the things we did discuss in our study group and meeting yesterday, you know, half an hour meeting, was, and perhaps you should come back, it's important for us to understand the method that you and the department use on SAFCO. Like, you see, we were actually impressed. We were using your words, literally. You know, like there was initially a notion we had when we came to this committee that SAFCO was being privatized. Members will recall what a hard time we gave before management. And I had to rescue them. We'd be impressed with me. I'm supposed to be more lecturing than others, some of the others here. I had to rescue them and say, actually, it's wrong to focus on the board chair and the CEO. This is really the minister. Whoever the minister was there. It should really be raising issues. So there was a very tough position, and then we heated up. And then you came on and you reminded us what we had said, and you took it much further, and in fact using your very evocative words, I don't know where you said this, some meeting. And so, in short, we want to understand a bit more, not now, there won't be the time, it's tennis to you, about how the shift occurs from, you know, a year ago, when we seemed as if the state was going towards a more direct involvement and recognizing the strategic asset that forests are, to now saying no, we don't think it's big enough. I mean, obviously people change their minds all the time. We're not questioning that. But we just think about, I'd like to understand the method or the strategic orientation that the thing is. Like, secondly, the point made by the two last comrades, I have also been approached, but I don't refer to you or the people, by three different companies. And for one, I must tell you, two of them that said, no culture of entitlement. They were really genuine people. And I refer them to Sam Call, and in fact, I think they met one of them. I spoke to the department officials, I can't recall. But the issues that Bonkosi, Eric, and Lindy, and he raised, and also we had to confront. You know, people bring up and explain, we don't have direct oversight. So this is an issue. There are also environmental and other issues that arise, not just job losses. You know, forests, I just know very little, but because of SAFCON, I'm taking keen interest. You know, we're reading stuff about the concern that even liberals have environmentalists, that somehow it's funny, these people support the private sector. Get heated up and the forests are being handed over. You know, all the keys, many people you and I knew from the 80s, you know, university academics, they also give me a hard time. Two friends and so on. So, in short, I really think we hear the discussion. We can't have it now. Then some quick observations about overall. We want to say that in the one thing we spent with the department, which is signaling to you, we felt the strategic plan was much clearer last year. But we're also thinking that what we're getting is a more concrete, programmatic orientation. Now, we're not really speaking of trends, but the department seems to be much more concrete already. We've seen the following program. In manufacturing program 4, the retail logistics responsibility will deal with some of the issues on SAFCO maybe. We think that, you know, once you came to us and said, or the DG, that
there's a paper being involved around the role of SOEs in the economy. Obviously, that was a cabinet thing, being processed, and you're a cabinet member, and so it's a cabinet. But at some stage, whatever form that exists in, maybe in the share or the management model, we'd like to get a better sense, because we were also grappling with issues, and we were always seen as a minister and a department on these issues. So we would like to engage with you around that, about the broader role of SOEs in the economy and society. We're also thinking about InfraCo. It's something I'm signaling to the researchers to think about and we're negotiating with the department and the SKA, but we don't have a technical understanding of InfraCo. So next week is going to be very good for us as Autumn School, which I want to thank you for and the department for. The program is extremely exciting. We will take that further. But in the public domain, because we're going to have public hearing, there is a lot of criticism of InfraCo or should the state have control. Now, when one listens to you, it's a very lucid explanation. Isn't there some way, I mean, we can't instruct a minister to write a press article. I would say that if you want country about it, it makes our life easier. You see, if people are going to come in the public hearing, they're experts. Poor Eric Boskamp, poor chairperson. What do we really know about this issue, right? So it would help as in the cooperative, sort of the cooperative government, if either the department or yourself, whoever, see some of this information and the perspective that's emerging this morning into the public domain, because on June 6th we're going to have everybody here, and we're going to be finding difficult as a committee to respond to them. So I'm short saying that maybe there needs to be some public expression of what you said there, which helps. And then a study tour of some sort to SKA or to understand this, speculate this area. How much do you know about it? So I don't know about really what sort of study tour we can do, but around InfraCo and SKA, maybe even before June 6th, if you can, can help us before we start processing the program. I'll just alert you that Bonnie Kotsky serves in the Communications Committee, and Chris Wong, as you know, is an IT expert. So they too will run with the program. And I'll just sit behind them, and every time they make a good point, I will take credit for it, and every time they botch it up, I will say, well, what is me for these two young people sharing? But they will take responsibility for the book. So, you know, even if it means the two of them, you know, Chris Wong or something, great, to visit, I don't know who, InfraCo and meeting with people, or getting a better understanding of SKA by meeting with the relevant people, we will discuss with the department. So much for my comments, except this is reminded me, we must tell you that setting decisions, but it's also, we didn't even tell the department yesterday, but sometimes, you know, we are always right. Because if you say certain things, the department gets very defensive, sometimes usually they are. And then 2 years later, you go even further to the decision we made. This is wonderful, look at EC. I don't know who, you see, every time you settle your department, I want to tell you one final thing. Your department is more of a politician than you and I are. Right? Every time we take on, they don't want to see the EE, we have nothing to do with training. So now we're going to call the DG and safety. But whoever takes responsibility for this, presumably now that we're supporting it, they will say, hey, responsibility. It's very likely, if the DG was initially established as the office responsible for privatizing SMEs, right? Straightforward. But as government fiscal position has stabilized, priorities have shifted, and the role of SOEs has been redefined. Wonderful to say redefined, rather than a strategic shift of emphasis. Instead of privatizing, we'd like to say, instead of privatizing, they will remain government on very to play a vital role in the economy, in line with the Senate Department's mandate. We just think, we were battling 2 years ago. This is almost like a restructuring, trying to present a consistency all over there. Now we see it's much more explicit than we ever would have thought before. But it's very facetious, but it also has truth.
Okay, let me very briefly make some comments because I think that the presentation can deal with SAFCO in more detail. I think the best way to describe the decision on SAFCO briefly is that some of the issues you've raised, and I'll touch on them in a second, are valid and important issues, and were issues that we were worried about. I think we've come to the conclusion that we could achieve those objectives without necessarily owning KLM and SAFCO. That was a decision we had to look at, the choice. What topic was it? Could we really influence? What were we doing? But you're right. Some of the experience in how we sold previous forests, we better look at closely and not repeat in this exercise. Particularly what we've said that we'll put much more effort on when it comes to the empowerment side, is more stable relationships where the empowerment partners can play a more important role and do things. With regard to exports and the changing types of log produced, we will look at that in the lease and license agreements, because it is correct that we would not like to see a massive distortion in our timber supply. So whilst the KLF is, I think, if I remember rightly, about 3% of total forest, it's 30% of sawlog. So it's more important in the sawlog sector. So there will have to be some careful consideration on the parameters and requirements of the sale transaction to protect that. We wouldn't like the sawlog industry to collapse and go into pulping and stuff like that. So we'll have to give some thought to it. But you, because it's a regulated industry, you've got some power. But that power needs to be best exercised, not by SAFCO, because these are sort of policy regulatory issues. That's why we feel it should move across to Department of Water Affairs and Forestry. And some of these developmental issues, supporting communities and that, are really something that could be handled more effectively in a department like forestry. The communities, I didn't mention, but you're absolutely right, Fernando. We have to work very closely with Land Affairs. And one of the biggest challenges, I think, that we have in the transaction is to get the communities fairly treated in a sustainable way. How do we do that? So this is not something we're going to rush into. We've got to look closely at the parameters. It will probably be a fairly detailed set of guidelines we give to the board in the transaction, more detailed than we would normally give for a transaction, because of the complexities that the members are raising. We've got to watch them fairly closely. One of the issues that we will try and deal with prior to the transaction is a more effective way of dealing with logs. All these arguments about quota systems, small players, this is a difficult area that we should try and improve in some way. We are not going to be able to solve the needs of every sawmill. So there's got to be some rationalization of it. But I think our feeling in the department is that we could probably devise a slightly better system. Often there's contractual links that is very difficult to break out of and change. But I'm sure the department will give you much more detail on that if you need that. Chair, on your overall comments, thank you very much. I must say I think that our current strategic paper and the business plan that's now been developed in association with it is the best we've ever done. I'm also pleased it's concrete, definite, clear, and I think we're in a much, much better position. Hopefully the autumn school will give you more insight into Infraco. SKA, as you know, is a project of the Department of Science and Technology. But the reason why it links with us so much is it was one of the factors that caused us to keep the infrastructure in our hands, because this is the scientific potential of this project and what could be done for South Africa is so exciting. Even if we don't win the big SKA, we're going to build smaller ones. Which will be permanent science facilities in South Africa. I do agree if the autumn school doesn't cover all the areas you want, it's organized more, because it's a very, very interesting area. We will try and be crisper on explaining InfraCo, but let me just warn you that the IT industry, the communications industry, are far worse than the clothing and textile industry. Everybody's got views on it.
Yeah.
And no one will ever reach agreement on this matter. The long, the short of it is very, very, very simple, is what I said. Basically, we've kept fiber optic cables city to city in our hands, and we're looking very closely at what we should do about undersea marine links. That's what we're doing. So we're not doing anything else in telecommunication. We're creating the basic platform that will be used by the telecommunications and ICT industry after that. Criticism that it's in state hands? Sure, I'm sure we'll get that criticism. But the long and the short of it is that the long and the short is the private sector and even a partially state-owned company didn't put in sufficient infrastructure. So we can't take the chance again. We can get the time to solve it. But thank you very much, Chair. Yeah, sorry I've spoken for so long, but I welcome these chances for a detailed interchange.
Thank you very much. It's tea time. Call the Thank you very much. We're back in 10 minutes.
Quite pointed in responding to last year's budget report. So let's move on from there. What other questions arise? All right. So while members are working through the documents, can I just very quickly questions about the outputs, right? The legal governance and risk you'll see on page 641 of the E&E. Now, management, you say, risk management, so frequency of monitoring, you're getting quarterly reports. Is that happening, right? Okay, I take it. Now, legal and litigation, you approved guidelines June 10, 2007. You're on course to do that, the two.
Yes.
Now, this April 2007, have you met that target? Process for board appointments and taking.
Actually, no. We, as I've indicated, we have a terms of reference out. We hope to complete that by the end of the first quarter.
One thing the DJ and I should maybe speak about over lunch or maybe next week. You're going to be there next week. I want to understand a bit more about how deadlines, this is a question Peter posed, how deadlines are arrived at. It's not about you, it's about the executive department. So, and we must write something in the report, but based on a better understanding of how you actually, what your method is doing, so that's all. I don't need to discuss that here. Can you remind me, Eric, next week to ask something about that, huh? We can talk over tea and then we'll, I'll draft that paragraph, okay? You know, you say 15 of the applications were approved, transaction 4 were declined. In what circumstances, with E&E page 11, right? Paragraph 2 there from the beginning. It just always declined. Now, those 4 transaction applications, 3 are currently being processed, 15 were approved, 4 were declined. So, E&E, page 641. So, there are 4 transactions, doesn't matter where it is. You say in your report to Parliament via the E&E that 4 of the transactions were turned down. Can I just have all the questions one time? You can organize your responses. Why were they turned down? I mean, what sort of circumstances? The other thing is that you said it's been, I don't understand fully, you said like yesterday, if I'm correct, that your legal litigation has increased, if that's correct. Last year you said you were going to reduce them. Am I correct? I'm going to understand you in regard to that. They're looking at your very busy slide, the first one particularly, legal. What's really the questions there? And then governance, and then the third slide, secretariat of management. Yeah. What's our question? There were a lot of questions.
Clarification.
One hand. Again, are you going to be, it's not going to be anything. It's not for the report. It also means if we understand that we wouldn't pose the same questions next year. Peter, Desmarine, Bonnie Cook, and Bonnie Cook, and then Desmarine. You might forget we asked by next week. You might have forgotten that we already asked the question next week.
Diploma. That's the Mozambican. Did I understand correctly yesterday that the Mozambican government is buying our shares in the?
We will be approaching the Mozambican government to indicate that we're selling and give them the first option
to buy
that diploma.
So if I understand, the Mozambique government's approach is to own this forest. Unlike us.
Well, basically, they've let us buy 80%. Seriously, they have sold it to us 80%. So I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case. But they might want to, and our view, frankly, is that it is basic infrastructure. And they have a huge quantity sector that's available. So if they can afford it, we would, and that's why we're approaching them, is that if we, it's exactly the same reason, if we had owned a much bigger chunk of KLM, we would be paid. It was when we looked at the economics from the ownership side that it just didn't make sense to own such a small package. So it's fundamentally just to give them the option to decide to keep it, buy it back, or if they say they don't mind, who buys it, then agree with them the disposal option.
Yeah.
one which is partially yours, partially mine. But I just want to check around the issue of following your explanation yesterday. If you look at the consultancy and so on, the consultancy, you've got a huge jump to 7 from 8. Then you go down to 3. And it's jumping from 1.7. What exactly is happening is the issues you have raised in terms of personnel and so on, or the other factors which are attacking that particular measure. I'll assume that it means there will be exodus of the rates going down the following year in terms of personnel or staff in the department. Well, what is the explanation around that particular figure? The second one says around the last year, there was a indication in terms of the breakdown of different SOEs in those who have already managed to put their risk management in place. Some of them at that point they could not have. Do you have such a breakdown? Because you remember there was Transnet, was still busy with Eskom having, and Eskom didn't have Transnet. Quite a number of them didn't have the risk management plan in place. So what is the progress now? I was just trying to go through. I could not be able to kick it up. The other question says that what is the progress or what is this? Because you remember that you indicated that you'll be forming this management risk forum where the DPE and also the SOEs will be meeting and so on. What is the progress around the what are you achieving in those forums? But in relation to the question I've asked initially in terms of those different SOEs and their risk management plan you are supposed to put in place. The other one check, I wanted to check whether are you hands-on. You remember we have raised the issue of reviewing the procurement policy of SOEs. What is your assessment in terms of that policy, procurement policy review? Are they working? What is it you have achieved? Because you were full with stress last time to say if you do that, the youth, the women, and so on should be family form part of the broader strategy of the procurement, in particular the local communities where those SOEs like the power station. I know around the issue of heat reviews, there's a huge problem in terms of the power station, the benefit of the community tender and other ones. The community don't seem to be benefiting from the tender from the power station, although it's in Mpumalanga, but the local community doesn't seem to benefit. How far did you go maybe to influence the SOE so that they look into those issues, the youth, the women, and also the local community extension?
Chair, I'm covered on risk forums and procurement, so I'll ask only two questions on the remaining issues that I have. The department has indicated on the booklet on the status on risk on SOD. I was wondering how far the process is in terms of that booklet, and whether it could be made available to the committee. And probably, if possible, if Sandra could just give us a sense of the key elements of the kind of risk that the SOEs are generally, you know, faced with. And then the last one, Chair, is on the...
draw attention to the table that Eric was referring to, right? It's on page 640. Now, if you look at legal and litigation, you're going to drop from 8 million to 5 million, is that right? Does that imply that there's a decrease in the number of cases you have to contend with? Governance and sicknesses jumped up from
last year 4.6 to 12.2. Can you just remind us why that is the case? And then under economic classification, the current payment jumping up from 14.9 to 22.6 million. And then goods and services from 4.08 to 10.34. Now you explain the increase at the bottom, and the increase is because of additional expenditure on the goods and services for outsourced capacity to meet the output targets for the year, as well as the result of risk management sub-program being moved over from the former analysis of risk management program. Okay, do you want to add to that? Okay, are you ready? You want to drop it? Yeah, well, you can bring it up later. It's not a big deal. Okay.
Okay, let me start with the issue of the transactions, why they were turned down. This would be, let me first indicate that when we assess the application for approval in terms of Section 54.2, we essentially assess whether the board has applied its mind in relation to appropriate transaction procedure, whether it is compliant, for instance, with obligations under the BEE Act, whether it's compliant with obligations under the Preferential Procurement Act. We would then also assess the fair value of the transaction, and then we would assess the risk related to that transaction and to what extent the transaction structure introduces risk mitigants to lower any transactional risk. If if we believe that the presentation or the submission does not cover all of those aspects satisfactorily, we would send the application back. In other words, we would decline the approval of that application. And in most cases, the SAE would go back and would go and reassess the way in which the structure or the transaction is put together. So it's not necessarily that in principle the transaction cannot go ahead. It's the way in which the transaction is put together. In most cases, it's usually a risk issue. What I should also indicate is, in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, Section 54.2, it is the responsibility of the board to actually resolve on the transaction and to apply to the executive authority, the minister, for this approval. Sometimes we receive applications that do not come from the board, and then we will send them back because we need the board to resolve on it. We need to ensure that the board has actually applied its mind. So it could be for any one of those reasons. These are the criteria that we apply. We've been receiving very positive feedback from the SOEs, indicating to us that in us having communicated these transaction guidelines, it's also making it clear to the board what the board's role is and management, what the key factors and considerations in those transactions should be. As far as the question on litigation is concerned, yes, indeed, as the point that I wanted to make is that litigation, whilst we set targets to reduce litigation, it is a factor which is extraneous. We don't control necessarily to the full extent the litigation that the department is involved with. We actually did, and this was reported on a quarterly basis during the last financial year, we did reduce outstanding litigation that had been pending for a long period of time. So just as we had reached our target, new litigation came in. And I mentioned the Intunzi case because in terms of quantum that's being claimed, it's quite a significant case for us to deal with. And if I may just link the chair's question on the cost of litigation to this particular point. The projections on the litigation cost is as known at that point in time. Litigation cost is a contingent liability in the National Treasury. If and when we are, through order of court, obliged to make a payment, we have an arrangement with the National Treasury where it's treated as a contingent liability. But that's on the basis of known potential liabilities at that point in time. I believe the DG has already responded to IPLOMA. From our legal officer's point of view, to distinguish the IPLOMA transaction from the KLF transaction, we will be providing a link with the government of Mozambique from a government-to-government perspective. As far as there were a number of questions related to the increase in budget for governance and secretariat, and you will notice that in that in the ENE, yes, for the current year there is a significant increase. Reason being one, additional new staff. Secondly, on the consultancy and business services side, I've indicated that we've had mixed success in terms of completing some of the governance modules of the shareholder management model. Our target is to have all of those completed by the end of the second quarter. And for that, we are buying in specialist services on certain items that are still outstanding. And so the cost, the increase in cost is basically to cover that assistance. It's important to note that other than one long-term consultant, our branch only makes use of, at this point in time, of short-term consultants. So the consultant cost here would basically be on a short-term basis to complete SMM module, and would be the cost of one long-term consultant, and that consultant is deployed in the risk management group.
If you could put it in a paragraph, not faster, you know the area better than me. But also linked to the point that DG made yesterday, it's an interesting point that you make a case that your own department is slightly unique. And when we're talking of consultants here, we're not talking of like the conventional term. You have to talk about staff and so on and so forth. And what are they really doing? So it's link the two, and then we may separate them and make a generic point about what the DG said. Or maybe under the section of what the DG said, you put that there, and then you explain to them. Can you move on faster to, you covered it, though, yeah?
Okay.
So then let's finish the remaining questions.
Chair, I think there are only three remaining questions. The one relates to the our line of insight into the procurement policies of the SAEs. I believe I've already touched on the fact that we assess that through our transaction approval. As far as the book is on risk is concerned, risk management framework will be published as a booklet. It's not out yet. I believe that in the next quarter we have scheduled a presentation to the portfolio committee on the risk management framework. As far as salient SME risk trends are concerned, we're in the process of compiling the data to actually again validate it with reference to example. But in general, I can tell you that through the functioning of the risk forum, one area where we believe we want to do further research is in general contract management across SME. As far as the risk, the tables of last year is concerned, yes, our apologies for not including it this year, but just to indicate to you that the risk forum is actually functioning very well. Initially, the purpose of the risk forum was to actually establish agreement on the risk management framework, the guideline structures. We are now moving into an assessment of what those salient risks are. So it is functioning very well. We've actually increased the depth of assessment as a group, the peer reference and analysis in the risk management forum is actually quite exceptional. Thank you, Chair.
Just one quick thing. The DG 2 years ago, I think, said to us that when you put in the transaction guidelines, one of the issues you are raising with them. So you want to say something? Can I just finish because it's related to what you said, right? It's basically, you recall, comrades and friends, when we had the DG 2 years ago, I think she said, well, I haven't got the report here, it's a previous report, but I think one of the things she said, which we're very pleased with, is that in your transaction guidelines, you are going to also look at the issue of people losing jobs, that you know, they're disposing of assets to. Obviously, there are some times where people, they have to lose their jobs, and it's unavoidable, but as far as possible, you won't just sign off on an effective disposal or whatever, unless you have some guarantee that the job losses that might follow are unavoidable altogether. Is that there the transaction guidelines?
Chair, we have, in the cases where businesses were closed, the cost of retrenchment was a consideration, and that applies, for instance, in the case of Danel. What is also important to mention to the committee, the transactions that we approve are so-called significant and material transactions. Now, what exactly that means is another matter. We will share that with you also, I believe, later in this year, some element of the shareholder management model. But one of the considerations or criteria in determining a significant and material transaction is the fact that there may be job losses. If there are job losses, it comes to us for approval.
On government center, the department spoke of working on a government workflow model. Which in principle is meant to ensure, you know, an effective coordinated way of communication across departments with SMEs. How far is that process?
As I've indicated yesterday, it's progressed quite far as an in-house product. We're getting in a service provider to actually bring the different links, the different connectors between activities together and to package that as a codified publication. We actually intend making it available as a publication to other departments as well. So it's progressed quite far. In fact, we have unpacked all the activities that governance, risk, and legal is responsible for, but it's being done by the staff themselves, and we're getting an outside assistance to validate that process.
Remind
me
what Chris picked up on. 6/12, we said the committee welcomes the government's workflow model that is being created, interested to pursue this further. We're interested in this. Because you see, you may not be making it idiosyncratic for us to ask about it, but we actually want to understand a bit more about how departments work and what government inflows are. And about the inflows are all where we function as a committee. So we would like to pursue that further with you. Let's move on. Is anybody else who's got a question to ask? We've got one last comment, Sandra? No,
thank you, Chair.
Now it's Catherine, is that right? Look, it's quarter past 12, so you can take half an hour if you want, but this is just 25 minutes, 20 minutes. Okay, bye.
Yeah.
So, thank you.
I
think you're negotiating with the department, you know, the internship stuff. Mm-hmm. It's our sent by the department. Okay, so for now, need to do this. The secretary, just to do with the internship, you gave it to us. Sorry? Oh, Chris, you. Oh, please. No, this must be for 91.
You'll recall that the
joint project facility was established in 2005 by the CEO Forum, and the main aim of this was to leverage the assets of the SOEs to have a developmental impact in South Africa, or to try and leverage synergies that we might find across the SOEs. Moving straight to the projects, a new project in the EME is the Aerostructures Industry Project, which we've just kicked off now in this financial year. There, conceptually, there's an idea that there are opportunities in South Africa, given the SOE Build program, that we might be able to develop an aerostructures industry. We have just started the project, and we're working on a pre-feasibility report at the moment, and we'll be having a workshop with some of the industry players towards June to get a better idea and a sense of how large that industry might be and what role we could play to build it in South Africa. On the rest of Africa, the DG spoke about it yesterday, and really the idea is to build some key infrastructure in South Africa, and we'll need to start looking at some projects to identify. There was no project manager for this project last year, and in fact he started this week. We're coming to present to the Portfolio Committee in the third quarter of this year on this project, so by then we'll have a firmer idea of which kinds of projects we'll be looking at. Last year, we produced a few reports, four reports in fact, on the benchmarking study of SOE investments in Africa, a lessons learned report, and we also did some region and sector studies in Africa. And really what I suppose this always happens with the project, as you go along you learn and you realize that actually had you known this at the beginning you would have done things differently. And I think what we realized as we were going along is that in fact the Africa question is much more complicated and requires a much more sophisticated analysis and answer than a sector analysis or a country analysis. And that in fact key logistics corridors or hubs are actually more beneficial to a country than finding a country with the lowest risk rating, or that there might be key countries in Africa that we'd want to have partnerships with or develop projects in. And again, this is also, I suppose, a bit of a sensitive project because I think Portia also mentioned possibly the SOE's appetite to invest in Africa that I experienced there. We haven't always executed projects as well as we would have liked to. So we need to take the lessons learned forward if we are going to execute projects in future in Africa. Another new project that you're seeing on the EME for this year is a partnership arrangement with Belarus. We have started to explore a few sectors where there might be opportunities for joint production. We realized that this project was really about providing us with mutual benefits through a partnership. So we might be able to provide each other access to each other's markets or technologies or set up joint production facilities. We initiated this project just in March, and we started to identify a couple of areas. The Belarusians are in fact having a return visit here in the next few months. And the areas that we're looking at there is around defense and capital goods. Belarus has got an excellent reputation in earth-moving equipment and capital goods. And on their return visit, we're also working with the Department of Science and Technology because they have quite advanced metallurgy sectors, which we're going to be talking to when they come back. And again, Chair, in the third quarter...
But it's a remote case, I can't justify taking a study to it, but let's see.
Chair, we're coming... But also we're coming back in the third quarter to talk about that project, so it should be a bit more advanced and there should be more to tell you in the third quarter about that. The Competitive Supplier Development Program. The idea behind this, we were just really in the early stages of thinking about it last year when it came onto our radar, which was this idea that, and then when we were talking about the Eskom Build program, it was 86 billion and now it's 150, and when it was 86, we were raising our eyebrows and saying, well, you know, how much of what we're buying is going to be imported, and how can we mitigate against that, and isn't there an opportunity here to develop the manufacturing capability in South Africa, but not just manufacturing capability in South Africa for the sake of local content, for the sake of BEE, but really to develop world-class manufacturing that is not going to have a price premium for South Africa, but could also, in the end, move towards export in some of those parts. So we started that project. We've had quite a good response. We submitted a cabinet memorandum at the beginning of this year because what we needed is the Department of Trade and Industry's agreement that our SOEs could, in a sense, substitute the National Industrial Participation Program with the Competitive Supply Development Program. And we have that approved by cabinet. Eskom and Transnet have written to us formally notifying us that they want to participate, and they need to produce their first draft program by July this year, which we'll look at in conjunction with TTI. They've basically got 1 year to put the program in place. And then also as part of this, it's not just about how much can we do in South Africa, but how smartly can we buy. So there's been a procurement officer's training program that we've been... and it's quite a sophisticated program. There was a 1 week boot camp, which by the sounds of things, I think CG was there, she can probably report on it, was definitely a boot camp. It was starting at 6 a.m. and ending at 7 p.m. and whipping our procurement officers into shape. And I think that's definitely going to be paying off in the long term, and we'll be running another camp later on. And again, we're coming back to you, in fact, on the 16th of May to report on the CSDP, and the project managers will be here, so you can... We can talk about that in quite a lot of detail.
But we need something that we don't...
At all things.
I wondered when, since we've got it, whether we should ask it to the teacher,
okay.
Or whether we should stop the committee, because we're doing this in lots of schools. Mm. But go ahead.
Okay. Energy and pipelines is around us playing a coordinating role in the liquid fuels and gas pipelines industry. There are quite a few players, some of them state-owned, some of them private, and in terms of our stable, Transnet own Petronet, and that's really where our interest is, but also making sure that there is sufficient liquid fuels supply in the country in the years to come so that we don't constrain growth. And there's three areas of pipelines that we're looking at: liquid fuels, natural gas, and slurry pipelines. On environmental issues, I think this is definitely a hot topic at the moment. Our role again is more one of liaison and smoothing over maybe. What we discovered when we started this project is that in fact sometimes our SOEs don't carry or didn't fully understand the EIA processes, or weren't carrying them out in a way that helped Departments of Environmental Affairs and Tourism make a decision. And equally, there are some areas on DEET's side that we thought could be improved. So we're actually working quite closely with DEET at the moment, with our SOEs and DEET to improve that. And one of the things that we're going to be looking at this year that's quite important is something that we call the Strategically Important Development, an SID or a SID. And about setting criteria, we're working with DEET on this, to set criteria to say what makes a development strategic, what is a SID, and then if it is categorized as a SID, how might we deal with it differently in the EIA process to make sure that the EIA gets issued in almost fast track. And in that sense, we're not looking for any exemptions. We've never said that we want to see that there need to be lesser environmental standards for power stations or ports. We absolutely agree that we do need to be protecting our environment as we go ahead with the build program. It's really a question of process and mechanism and how we can do that in a way that we can build our infrastructure and save our environment at the same time. So our work on the SIDs will be quite crucial this year. And if we can get it printed in time, we'll be producing what we call our SIDs leaflet for the budget vote, where we've identified Eskom, Transnet, and Eskom and Transnet 38 key strategically important developments. This is also slightly complicated by the fact that, of course, we're not the only ones who are building things that we think are strategically important. So we're also working with the presidency and the seat, because there are many other sectors that would also want to be included in the SIDS process. So ours is just really a piece of the pie that we think are very important to.
It's actually your own, or it's part of the international policy?
say I'm not sure. I put a portion to the speech. But how heavily can you buy? On the human resources and capacity building project, in fact, last year we really concentrated on the artisanal technical and technologist training programs. Just also kind of tied in with competitive supplier development program and the EIA project, which is to say, if we are embarking on this massive build program, are we certain that we have enough skills in the country to fulfill the requirements of that? So we started doing some information gathering last year around what kinds of skills we'll need, and the more we dug, the more horrified we got. We've also been working with the GIPSA project, with GIPSA, to feed that information into forming a national picture, because again, you know, as important as our build programs are, we're competing with other sectors and other industries for the same skills. So we also realized that in fact it's not such a simple equation of saying Eskom are building this many power stations and you need this many welders, or we need to look at the whole project pipeline for the country to see how we're going to synchronize some of that build and some of that training. We are busy talking to our SOEs about workplace experience, because in looking at which skills we require, you know, so this is also one of those things where we realize that the solution is much more sophisticated and complicated than we initially thought. We're now working quite closely with Department of Education and starting to talk to Department of Labor. Department of Education are doing wonderful things with their FETs and their recap program, and one of the areas that they find lacking is finding workplace experience for people that are coming out of the FETs. So we're just putting a program together that we need to propose to our SOEs in the next couple of weeks. And maybe we can talk to you more about that as the year goes on, if we want to get sign-off on that. There are other areas in the human resources project that we didn't talk very much about last year, but are starting to look at more holistically now, which is really thinking about the four tiers of education, that we're simply not seeing enough matriculants with maths and science, and that needs to be addressed. Then the artisanal training, which we've spoken about always, professional training, and then also advanced education and higher skills and R&D and science and technology type projects. So I think as the year progresses, you'll see a more sort of holistic approach to those four tiers of training. On the ICT project, well, I suppose in our minds we've launched Broadband Infrastructure Co, and it's now an SOE, which Lisa will be talking about. The one project that remains is the call center project, and DG highlighted yesterday that our problem there has always been to find a client, which we haven't managed to do yet, although we think we have two potential clients, one for Athlone FET up the road, and another one for an FET in Burgersport, and we're waiting for confirmation from those two clients. They're busy looking at the numbers. And again, this project will be made possible by Department of Education and really their foresight and vision in wanting the FETs to get involved and be a place of work and work experience for their students, because they're introduced to call center training as part of their curriculum. On the property project, we were coming to present to you, in fact, on the 30th of May on this. You'll recall that last year we established a framework for disposals of non-core properties for SOEs, and we also had... we received cabinet approval for the BBBEE guidelines for disposal. Really what we're waiting for is to kick off with the disposals. We were, I don't want to say delayed, but it has taken some time. When we went to cabinet with the guidelines, some other government departments asked for access to the lists of the properties for disposal, because they would have liked to identify maybe key properties that they might require. and the Department of Housing came back to us with quite a large requirement, and we've been in negotiation with them for about a year now on the Transnet list, and there's quite a big portion of property that they are intending purchasing to alleviate the housing crisis in South Africa. So as soon as we finish that transaction, we can then actually go public with the rest of the disposals from the Transnet list. And then there were also other properties which we identified, which we call the key integrated projects, which were places around ports or inner cities that were strategic pieces of land that we thought, rather than just selling to the developer or selling on the open market, if we had some influence over the way in which they might be developed before they disposed, we could actually contribute to inner city growth and development. That's the text done with. We are waiting to finalise, as the port master plan has been developed and finalised, and the same with the rail master plan, and there's some issues around EIAs and whether or not it's possible to expand the container terminal in Cape Town or not. There's been an ongoing discussion with our SOEs about which pieces of land they can actually give up for those key integrated developments. So we haven't yet finalised and locked down and said these are the exact pieces of property, these are the earth numbers, and this is how it's going to be structured. But we are anticipating doing that quite soon with our SOEs. Chair to the table, that really talks to our outputs for the next 3 years and what we plan on doing. This is pretty much what I've just said. Chair, some of the things that and also in, not to blame Treasury, but in the E&E you lose some of your projects in the tables because they only want to see three really important ones, and sometimes I'm not able to decide which are the three most important, so they decide. So the one thing I didn't mention on the competitive supply development program is that the 0.3 for steel and scrap sourcing strategy, Eskom and Transnet have agreed to come together to do a joint sourcing strategy, recognizing that their buying power individually is enormous, but together is just quite staggering. So they're working together on that, which has been quite exciting for us to see. If there's anything else that I haven't mentioned. A humble budget. and really, besides things like travel and whatever, it's really the cost of our project managers for the 10 projects that we have. Not all the projects have project managers. But some of us are employees, which in the strict kind of civil service definition of employee are employees, and the rest of us are long-term contractors. And we actually don't employ short-term contractors the way Sandra spoke about it. And they're more or less contractors that look like employees to the rest of us. It's only a matter of the way we've contracted with them that makes them not employees. But then I thought if I do that. No, it's also just this issue of squaring this with the E&E and the way that the number always adds up to the same thing, but if you look at the E&E, it looks slightly different. But the N number's the same.
Now, if this one is not ready, can you pick up on the document as well? What are the issues you want to raise?
Well, with regard to the pipeline, you say you need to make sure we have sufficient pipeline capacity to take liquid fuel from outside. But I understand that the responsibility to ensure that there is enough liquid energy, what do you call it, petroleum, would who that regard? It's another department, the private sector. You know, we keep on seeing when we run short of fuel, when they have to clean tanks and so on. Can I just go about three of them? And then also your relationships with other departments, is it complementary, is it competitive? I remember one of the meetings we had here in 99 State, I think that somebody was complaining about the Department of Transport and how long it takes to get agreements with other government departments, particularly where you have a servitude, let's say Department of Transport as a servitude, and you need to access that servitude. Has there been improvement in that kind of relationship? I don't know if it falls under your section in particular. Your call centers, as I say correctly, the FET was provided as a course and the call center would be based as part of the FET. So they provide a source of income to the FET also. And then the property disposal. Now, I don't know if I'm correct, but all the properties were owned for under public works, or do you have your own property? And would it not make sense that we have some sort of central depository of all state-owned properties, so that if Transnet doesn't need property, it gets shifted back to that particular body, for lack of a better word. That it's there, and everybody knows there's this long list of properties, and whichever state department needs land can look at that first. And I'm just concerned that we might be getting rid of valuable state-owned land for short-term needs.
I want to follow up on the property project. I understand that there is a guideline to manage the disposal of the land court. I see that also from this year, the majority of that property will be sold in the open and competitive market. And yet, within that framework, there is still guidelines for your broad-based like economic empowerment. I just want to understand in the manner in which the framework itself is structured, is there a specific balance or percentage or portion or share that is specifically put aside for your BBBEB and then the rest to the open and competitive market? Because I'm a bit worried when it says the majority of the very same property within which the framework also seeks to, you know, redirect such into your broad-based like economic empowerment group. So can I get clarity, sir, because I feel there is some kind of thing. Whatever. Thank you.
I think my lady can be responded maybe in a form of a report. I'm just interested that the DC yesterday indicated about the call center and some challenges. The issue of Adlon has also come up. But I was just looking at page 47 of the presentation where you talk about call centers in other cities, areas and so on. I know, Chef, we also know that there are discussions to say where are the underprivileged exactly, are at the rural or at the urban, what type of discussion. But I just want to check whether it will be commercial sensitive to know who are the actual areas that have been identified for call center. Is that commercial sensitive? If it's not, maybe you can provide to that. The second issue, Chef, is that I so wish that one day the department can come and say they've taken a strategy for support for this call, or for any of the big SOEs to take their head office to one rural area. Can you imagine how well would be the development in terms of infrastructure and so on? It's my dream that one day ISCOM can go to Bushbuck Ridge.
Thanks, Jess. Can I just help me understand the particular project on Red South Africa? How important or how is this relationship in relation with the GP's core mandate and mission in terms of, I know it's obviously it's important to look to work with other countries and it made an important skill, but how in particular paying attention to our sister goal and the employed youth within South Africa, how is this particular project going to assist, if any, or any, if this is going to be a short-term, medium, or long-term project before we see the benefits.
Starting with the pipeline question about whose responsibility is security of supply, as far as I understand it, it's a question for the Department of Minerals and Energy, but we do believe that we have an important role to play since one of our SOEs owns a key pipeline in the economy. And so that's really our role in that. And again, it's one of the ham and the sandwich. It's a coordinating role, and at the end of the day, you're right, it's not ours, but we certainly think that we need to make sure that there's sufficient supply, and at least on our pipeline, going forward. In terms of our relationship with other departments, I think certainly it's complementary. Of course, we're all people and we all work under pressure, but my experience on this project has been nothing but excellent on the Competitive Supply Development Program. We've worked very closely with DTI, Science and Technology, also the CSIR, the environmental project. There's a lot of work that we do with DEET, and they've been truly wise, you know, that they are working hard with us on this. The call center project, Department of Education, have been fantastic on the skills project. Education and Labor have both come forward willingly and openly to help us. So I think certainly those relationships are very good. And the other departments are very supportive of what we do. I suppose maybe it's a little bit difficult for us because we're not a policy-making department, we're a shareholding department, and we need to work with policy-making departments. So I think in the end we all have the same goal, which is to reduce poverty and hard unemployment and have a high growth rate, but our emphasis is probably slightly different since we're a shareholder and a policy. But certainly we're working together on that. On the call centers located at FET, Department of Education have introduced the syllabus to train people at the generic training on call centers, but we also intend hosting it at the site of the FET, and Department of Education have in fact offered some incentives to do that from the recap budget for those FETs. So there will be both training from the FET side, but also the clients, because the training is usually quite generic, and obviously at times we've got very specific training, so the client would top that up in a sense with their own specific training, and they would be located there. As to the locations, at least we can say that's definitely not a secret, although I can't name them off the top of my head, I'm rather embarrassed, but I can certainly get that to you. And in terms of deciding them, it was also a process. Once the Department of Education actually suggested to us that we use FETs, the Department of Education also identified FETs that might be more suitable or more ready to do that. So it was really a joint effort in terms of identifying those FET sites, but we can certainly get that to you. In terms of the property disposals and who owns what and how do we clear this and so on, that seems like a difficult question that we've had to answer also in government, because we must remember that these properties are owned by the companies Eskom and Transnet. They're not CCE properties, and they sit on those companies' balance sheets. And in effect, they're selling them to fund something else. So they do need to realize value for them, and it's not a question of putting it in the pool or stocking it. So no matter what, they need to realize value for it. And they sit on their balance sheet as a company asset. So when they dispose of it, that's where it could go. The rest of the state assets are in fact owned by Public Works Europe, but not Eskom and Transnet and the other SOE assets.
Next reason,
if
the SOE is public to handle, in fact, the largest land holdings were in Transnet by a farm, by a mine, and the next not so great land holdings are Eskom, but they very much tinier and in the case of the transaction that was done with housing, frankly, those are that housing got on the assets, on the properties that were shifted to them. And I think it's a standard that we have. The other government department is that they will come back and indicate what they want. Now, the problem, for example, in the Department of Education, they wanted a property which frankly had
commercial application and also was regarded by the SOE as a strategic asset. So we end up in a battle with them over a piece of property like that. But I think as far as possible, we try to lift the spirit and ensure that if it's possible that we can sell directly to the state, we should sell directly to the state.
But the boards have a responsibility to the company to make sure that they realize that.
I think it's important that Sandra answers this question, because there's one, it's a constant battle that we have in government, is that people are of the view that we own these companies. Surely, I mean, it's exactly the vexed question that existed for a very long time on EDI, where the view was to take the distribution assets under Eskom and shove them out. You cannot do that legally, because these are entities. What we own in the shares, the assets are owned by the company itself. So, I don't know.
Sure. I just wanted to check, you see, it's a very important question. You see, the minister said, these are not just ordinary companies. Once they look at profit, they also got their social responsibility. Where do we draw the line in this instance? Because you see, I fail to argue where at one point we argue solely on the issue of their profit, because their response was that they are also losing their profit in terms of what comes because they want to finance something else. And where do we draw the balance there? Because of this responsibility, what is a state owned, and that's why they are distinct from the private owned company. How do you draw that line? Because the line seems to be there, but in other areas it seems to be broad, so not broad. No, thank you. But I just want to know where to draw the line.
Especially in the context of the development of the case.
Yes.
All of the statements made are actually correct, but it goes back to the point the minister made that we need to draw a distinction between a government agency and a company, the context, the market context within which these companies operate. And as the minister explained, for instance, if you take the example of Transnet and Eskom and the value of the credit rating that those companies have in terms of their balance sheet, is dramatically important, I think was the minister's word, for our macroeconomy. Now, the fiduciary duty of a director of a company of that kind is to actually maximize the value of assets. And it's actually to our benefit, because that's how they maintain those balance sheets. If those companies, the way in which those companies are governed, and the way in which those companies are able and capable of actually transacting in a way that would actually protect the balance sheet is very important for the country as a whole and for the fiscus in terms of funding socio-economic development. Now, whether the government, whether Eskom and Transnet sells property at the low market value, or whether the fiscus sponsors an acquisition by the Department of Works, the money's got to come from some public pocket, if I could put it that way. But if it comes directly from Eskom and Transnet, selling at the low market value, as a consistent pattern, I will guarantee you we will not be able to maintain our credit ratings, because we will not be allowing the board to run those companies in terms of their fiduciary duty. It's just the context within which they operate. It's much more important to actually have the transparency to show the government, when it buys back at fair market value.
Thank you.
comes back to the point you raised earlier. We need a more like literary for the politicians, a political discussion around these issues, the role of state and enterprise.
You see, the thing that strikes me is that this is a matter that we also need to discuss in our study group, because there are slight differences, technical, not major, between us. And I think that discussion with your organization will help us. But you see, the thing that struck me, members of the committee, I hadn't thought about it before, but the minister said it this morning. You see, he's right when he says that we have had massive investment programs for railways and so on, right? But it was done through the national fund, the national budget. You see, so it's for sure, this is the first time we're going to the capital market to actually raise those funds. Now, you know, personally, I mean, I need to work with things, not be to do with you, to share some broad ideological, let's say, perspective. And I think actually, along, I think the study group as a whole is quite consensual about these things. But you see, personally, I don't know how to deal with these issues, but I am less now, let's say, weary than 2 years ago. Maybe people say I'm starting out, which is fine, let's discuss it. You see, previously I came from a more like traditional approach, which is, you know, the sort of thing that Kumita said. I also share that view. But now I'm a bit more convinced that actually there's nothing wrong with going to the capital markets to raise money. And can I put it crudely? I'd rather they sold the property to Kumita at a market value and then use the gains of that to deliver electricity to the poor. You know, like that's a trade-off. I'm not saying this as a discussion. I'm signaling where Jez Wally is. Just know that Jez Wally is going to help us to organize a discussion for ourselves. And then we need a political discussion in our study group. And then we need the minister to come and all the portfolio committee in a discussion. But you see, every year, Kosha, when we discuss the budget, every year when we discuss the report, that the same issues arise of, let's say, perspective and strategic orientation of the members of the ANC, forget the other party. You know, for now, because we ourselves are not having a full-blown discussion on this issue. It'll be helped, this whole thing, because then you won't get the same question next year, necessarily. But you see, what she's saying is correct. The question is correct, but the answer she's providing, I mean, not necessarily. But I think you've been in the sixth class too much in the other direction. Big opportunist I am. I'm something between Mama Kondlo there and yourself. But I think we need a discussion. Peter, you want to say something?
Yes, Chairperson. I think it might be useful to get somewhere along the line, people who can understand things much better than us, an external opinion of what value of ESCOM. The ownership of these properties, you know, the 1,600 kilometers strip of land that Eskom owns between up north and Cape Town, how much value does that add to Eskom in terms of when it goes to the market? The way I'm also being told is markets like stability, they like surety. So if the market knows that the properties of Eskom and Transnet are, when not needed, get disposed of back to government, they have a certain, they start acting in terms of that. It is, if you say, if every, out of the blue, we decide not to resell land back to the state at a discount, very substantial discount, that is what will disturb the market. So I think it might be useful to find out, you know, how much impact does ownership of these lands, unused lands, contribute to the value of these companies?
I mean, briefly, I've just asked my office to get me, and I'll give you a copy. It's quite an interesting document. It has elements of complexity, but also it's got elements of really being very interesting, because we have to go through that ourselves. You know, each time whenever we approach ESCOM in particular, and we would raise tariffing or whatever issues it was related to return and the rating line, we'd often be told by ESCOM that it has a rating impact, a credit rating impact for the return to the rating line. Being a skeptical economist myself, I was a little bit doubtful that one shift in an indicator could lead to a re-rating altogether. So over, I've been speaking to Treasury, so Treasury has got me a collection.
justified, because then when rating agencies look at it, they then decide whether they give it 1 to 10. In fact, one of them rates from 1 to 4. And then on the back of the shortest, for example, the UK would be rated as 1 on electricity, and South Africa's system is rated 4, which is the lowest rating. So you know that if there's any shift in that, you actually get worse ratings than that, and that then has an impact. And they were quite explicit in showing us which elements of the rating actually will lead to a downgrade. Now, what is absolutely clear for us already is that despite, for example, I think Eskom's rating is an A1, or A1. Yes, A1. It trades at a discount to the sovereign, despite the fact that actually its rating is higher than the sovereign's rating. But it trades at a discount to the sovereign because its rating at Eskom itself is actually A3, as the enterprise itself. So it's the combined rating which actually puts it at a much lower level when they take Eskom as the enterprise plus the state rating, and then they get it a combined number. But when Eskom goes into the market, Eskom is rated on the back of Eskom as standalone enterprise. So those kinds of things, I mean, so let's say, properties are not an active part of their balance sheet. And that's why, actually, what we will see is that you see the stuff that either you say was disposed by a transaction, it was sold to government or whatever, it was sold to. But there's a lot of properties, actually, that have been transferred for free to municipalities if we haven't had any real use. The municipality has better use for the properties and not. So we have as a standard being fairly balanced, but we must also remember that PFMA is quite explicit in saying that there must be fair value, and that responsibility is not actually the shareholder. It's the executive authority, the accounting authority, the board, on the enterprise, and it must be fair. So the true question and the place where we do play is where there's a book value price, which is much lower than the market value, and that's where the discount rate is. You charge book value, you charge a market value, and we try to actually sort of like balance those two invariably when we undertake the transaction. Quite mindful. And I get to your point, Peter. I know that the Department of Land Affairs or housing, are taking up an SPV, a property SPV, which is going to be buying up. So that then does create this opportunity that whenever possible, they become the acquirers of they buy the property from the SOEs wherever it's viable.
Actually, we've got a break for lunch. There is a sense in which you see, call it the majority party, for want of a better term, is to use a parliament that may be identified in the committee meeting, is a sort of democratic, if you like, orientation. And what we're doing here, I think, in some senses, is globally breaking in. I think it's finding a new path for parent faithfuls and faith-owned entities and what have you, and there's a distinction in the two, I know, that actually is a modern social democratic project. And I think some of the thinking that's taking place in DPE and the ministry and in the governing party in its preparation for its policy conferences and electoral conferences, those who are not members of the party, because it's a governing party, it's not easy for them to read the documents because it provides a broader framework for some of the thinking. I really think some aspects of it is quite interesting and innovative. Let's also say that Desmond has raised a few questions, and because she does so much of work, and she's not here, I just want to quickly, for 2 minutes, Kathleen, she asks, okay, this is a call center and broadband technological. She asks, what expenses count as other on the IT goods and services supply set? Well, probably with regard to disposal non-profits, but she says, on specific measures taken to ensure the availability of skills, last question, what makes up more detailed work with regard to the highly specialized skills? You must have used that term somewhere. And then with regard to the CSD sub-program, how do they... Okay, her question is, I don't fully understand her question. She says, JCF intends to secure increased value add from national suppliers with no increase in total cost of procurement. How do they intend to do this, given the fact that there are already key input shortages in the domestic sector and the local suppliers are not currently capable? Ah, here's your point, yeah. Could you reply to that question from the record? 1 minute, please. So, the other, we can listen to the other. Does anybody know what's the other?
Other is made up of all of in the standard chart of accounts we have, and in the economic classifications you have all these listings, and in fact these are things that would be made up of smaller amounts. I'm trying to think of certain things. Okay.
One point that arises is it jumped up from 1.8 to 7.8 million, from 07, 08 to 08, 09. Then the question about how are you going to manage the C&D thing? Well, you're going to increase the procurement costs, but you're going to focus on local suppliers. That's the question. You want to answer that later?
One of the things that we argue is that with the national industrial participation program, whether you recognize it or not, there is a price premium for it, and all suppliers price it in. Now, one of the things that we looked at as well was that if you look at the current, and she's absolutely correct, is that in the current supply condition, the pricing is way out. I mean, it's the seller's market, it's definitely not a buyer's market in every single sense, so you already have price premiums already. But the argument that we mentioned that if you look at the long-term cost of most of the inputs, if you have domestic manufacturing, you significantly reduce the cost over the long term. In the initial phases when you set up the operation, there may be price premiums, but in the long term, when you look at the life cycle cost of whatever inputs, whatever product, whether it's turbines or boilers that you're looking at, by virtue of the fact that, at least in the initial phases, the fast-moving parts, which are the parts that you have to replace on a regular basis, would be sourced domestically, dramatically reduces the cost of those inputs, because you're now not competing in an open market. You're in a space, in a confined space, where you have captured markets directly.
On the steel, sorry, I was looking through the
center. Okay. Just very quickly, it's 5 past 1. We only need about 40 minutes. We can divide it 1:45. And then I said, yes, the remaining program, half an hour, half an hour. If all goes well, 4:00 p.m.